Chairman, members of the committee, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. It's an honor to be invited to speak here today. It's really a pleasure. As the chairman said, my name is Glenn Whitman. I'm an associate professor of economics at California State University, Northridge. I should also probably tell you what I'm not. I'm not a resident of Minnesota. In fact, this is my very first visit here. So
would you like to be?
We'll see. We'll see. I'm checking it out. I can't claim to know anything specific about this state in as much as I don't live here, and I don't claim to be an expert on its particular alcohol regulations. In fact, I live in California, which has one of the most open and liberal alcohol regimes in the country, so it's very, very different. But what I am is an economist, which means that my experience and training is in examining the effects of economic regulatory policy and how they affect consumers. And I've had a special interest in alcohol regulation in this country ever since I began researching my book, Strange Brew, Alcohol and Government Monopoly, a few years ago. After writing that book, it came to the attention of various people, including grocers in this state, and so I came here primarily to speak with them, to let them pick my brain, and of course that gave me the opportunity to speak to you as well, for which I'm very grateful. What I found in general as a result of looking at this industry is that alcohol regulation in this country tends on net to create inordinate profits for certain special interests, especially distributors and sometimes retailers, and simultaneously harming consumers through higher prices, reduced variety, and reduced convenience. So what I hope to do today is talk about the reasons for that. What I'm going to do, first of all, is to give you a brief history of alcohol regulation in this country, much of which may be familiar to the people on this committee. Second, I'm going to talk about the economic effects of the resulting system. And third, I'm going to talk about the politics of regulatory reform. So let's go to the first item, a brief history of alcohol regulation in the United States. Let's go all the way back to 1933, which is the year that prohibition was repealed by the 21st Amendment. At this point in history, prohibition was widely regarded as a big failure, and so the desire was to re-legalize alcohol. But there was also a sense on the part of the drafters of the 21st Amendment that they wanted to leave states with the option to continue prohibition if they wanted to within their own borders, or to regulate alcohol in some other way if they chose. So the second section of the 21st Amendment included the following passage. It said, "The transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited." So the intent here, again, was to allow the individual states to continue to choose their own form of alcohol regime without interference, for the most part, by the federal government, and indeed with the support of the federal government. Now, the result of this was not that any state chose to continue prohibition entirely. None of them banned alcohol completely. 18 states did become control states, which are states that have a monopoly on the distribution and importation of wine and spirits, and sometimes maintain a monopoly on retail sales as well. The remaining states, usually known as licensed states, left distribution and sale in the private sector and then adopted a variety of regulatory schemes. These schemes differ dramatically from each other in a variety of ways, but all in all, what they were all designed to do was to support and entrench what is known as the three-tier system of alcohol marketing. Now, I imagine you're mostly familiar with the three-tier structure, but just to review, the three-tier structure consists of suppliers, who include vintners, brewers, distillers, and importers, and then they are required to sell directly to distributors, also known as wholesalers, and then the distributors must sell to retailers, your liquor stores, grocery stores, restaurants, and others who then sell to the general public. And in general, with the system that was created, suppliers are not supposed to deal directly with retailers, and distributors therefore have a kind of guaranteed market position. They are guaranteed a position because of the fact that you cannot have these direct contacts between the suppliers of alcohol and either the consumers of alcohol or the retailers of alcohol. And so that means you have to go through a middleman. It's a mandated middleman position. Now, what was the purpose of entrenching this three-tier system? the intent, at least at the time, was to avoid what was regarded as an institution of the pre-Prohibition era, the Tide House Evil. It was actually called the Tide House Evil. A Tide House was a pub or saloon that was entirely owned and operated by a supplier or producer of alcohol. And the perception was that these Tide Houses were responsible for a variety of abusive marketing practices. In particular, very prominently trying to push their products and get the workers to come in and spend their wages in order to spend as much as they could on the particular product that was being produced by this particular supplier. In fact, there's an interesting connection to one of the favorite sayings of economists, favorite mottos of economists: there's no such thing as a free lunch. That phrase originated with the Tide House pubs, because what they would do is they would offer a free lunch, a so-called free lunch to workers. But of course, the free lunch would consist of a salted pork sandwich. And so if you came and ate the salted pork sandwich, you'd be very thirsty and end up buying a lot of beer to wash it down with. Now, because of the belief that these Tide Houses were somehow responsible for what were perceived as the excesses of alcohol use, after Prohibition ended, the desire was to make sure that the Tide Houses couldn't come back, and so a variety of laws were passed at the federal and state level to make sure that there was going to be someone between the producers and the retailers of alcohol. Now, as an aside, I should mention that I've never been entirely convinced by this argument that these Tide House structures were really responsible for those abuses. The argument's never been entirely clear. If you think about it, we actually have plenty of the same kind of promotional practices going on now, even though we have the mandated three-tier system. We have the reduced prices associated with happy hours. We have salted peanuts and salted pretzels, which are offered for free at bars. You might wonder why they're doing that. It is, of course, because they're not trying to promote any specific product, but because they're trying to promote the whole array of alcoholic products that they have. So it's not entirely clear, to me at least, that this argument actually works. But nonetheless, the political reality of it is that it was that argument that led to the entrenchment of the three-tier system in our regulatory structure. So with that said, what I want to do is move on to talking about the economics of the three-tier system and what effects it actually has. First of all, it's important to recognize that a three-tier system is not inherently a bad system. Actually, it makes a great deal of sense to have a separation of sorts between these different levels of the business in the supply chain. You have the suppliers, the distributors, and the retailers, and that system is pervasive in a whole variety of other industries. Soft drinks and food, all of these are areas where we have distributors, and that makes sense because of the fact that distributors are able to achieve substantial economies of scale by having large shipments and by combining products from many different producers in order to enable those large shipments. So there's every reason to believe that we would have something like the three-tier system even if we didn't have the laws in place that tend to gird it. However, the efficiency of that system does depend, in these other markets, crucially, upon the possibility for competition. In other words, the possibility for a retailer or a supplier, if they don't like the job or they don't like the prices that are being offered by the distributor that they're currently working with, to be able to move on to another distributor, or maybe to provide their own distribution network, or to deal directly with retailers, in other words, to cut out the middleman. Now, that possibility means that there is a competitive constraint upon the distributors. If they don't do a good enough job, if they raise their prices too high, if they don't keep product quality high enough, there is this possibility of going to an outside option. Remove that outside option, and you're not going to have the distributors being as effective or as efficient. It's also worth noting that in a number of states, though not in the state of Minnesota, you have what are called franchise protection laws, which even reduce further the amount of competition among distributors. Very briefly put, essentially what these franchise protection laws are is they are a legal device that turns contracts between suppliers and distributors into a kind of Roach Motel. You remember the old Roach Motel advertisements where they said you can check in, but you can't check out? The idea here is that if a supplier establishes a relationship with a distributor, they cannot easily terminate that relationship even if their contractual term comes to an end, or even if there is demonstrable malfeasance, because of the fact that these laws require them to continue in that relationship and give inordinately long periods of time for correction of any errors and so on. And so these, in a number of states, help even further to entrench these particular established incumbent middlemen in the system. Now, what is the effect of all of these things combined? We've had substantial concentration in the distributor sector. from over 6,000 distributors in 1950 to about 600 today. Now, it's worth noting, not all of that reduction would be attributable to the regulatory structure, the regulatory apparatus that supports this system. Obviously, there are also the economies of scale, which grow with the size of national distribution, and so for that reason, there's good reason to believe that we would have had at least some of that concentration happening anyway. But there's also good reason to believe that the regulatory structure has contributed to it and made this concentration happen even faster. Now, it's also worth noting that if you look at national markets concentration data to find out how concentrated this sector is, it's actually going to overstate the amount of competition that's actually going on. In the year 2000, the top four wholesalers in the United States accounted for only 30% of all alcohol sales. But if you look at figures like that, it will grossly overstate the amount of competition because some distributors only operate in certain regions of the country. And so their national market share figures will exaggerate their influence in the areas where they're not actually present. In other words, if you have a distributor that's very large in California but is not present in New York, then that distributor is effectively irrelevant for determining the amount of competition that is taking place in New York, and vice versa. And so it turns out that in most markets, you actually have a very, very small number of effective distributors, usually between 1 and 5. And the result of that, again, is a reduced amount of competition taking place. And this creates what is referred to in economics as the double markup problem. And the double markup problem refers to the fact that prices are going to tend to be very high for consumers because of the fact that they're getting markups not just from the supplier, not just from the retailer, but also from the distributor in between as well. And it turns out that this hike in prices is not just bad for the consumers. Actually, it turns out the hike in prices is actually higher than the prices would go if you were trying to pick a price that maximized the joint profits of all of the firms involved. To see why, think about it this way. When a distributor chooses to raise the price of the alcohol that he's selling, he will get all the benefit of that increment in price. At the same time, because of that higher price, you're going to have a reduction in sales, and that reduction in sales is a cost that ends up getting felt by the distributor, but also by the retailer and by the supplier. So what they do is they get to get all of the benefits of a price hike for themselves while spreading out the cost among themselves and other firms as well. So this gives them an incentive to raise prices higher than they otherwise would. And by the way, this applies for the pricing decisions of the retailers and the suppliers as well. So you should expect to get inordinately high prices, and indeed, what we find is that alcohol distributors typically have a markup of between 18 and 25%. The same problem, we should note, affects the relationship between distributors and retailers. If you don't have sufficient amount of competition at the retail level, then retailers can also mark up prices. They'll get the whole benefit of that price increment, and then they will spread the cost of that between themselves and the distributors and the suppliers. The double markup problem does not have to be a problem. It's not an insurmountable issue. The main way that you can fight it is by having increased competition at each tier of the system in order to reduce the problem. More competition at the distributor level will reduce the distributor's markup. More competition at the retail level will tend to reduce the retailer's markup. It's also worth pointing out there is another effect of this regulatory system that entrenches this middle tier, and that's that the power of distributors can also reduce variety. Distributors make the most sense economically when they are able to achieve economies of scale. But making small shipments from small suppliers, like independent vineyards and brewers, often doesn't make a lot of sense for them. And what they can do is they can restrict the variety and then not allow these other opportunities for the people they're selling to. And if the people they're selling to don't have the ability to say, okay, this distributor isn't giving us a great enough variety, if they don't have the opportunity to go to another distributor, then they're able to get away with that. And that ends up being harmful both to consumers in terms of variety and also to your small-scale vineyards and other producers that would like to have access to a wider market. The result is that it's often hard for retailers and consumers to be able to find each other for these niche brands. Okay, so those are the primary economic effects of the three-tier system as it is currently regulated in the United States. So now what I want to do is talk a little bit about the politics of regulatory reform. And the main thing that you need to understand here is that the entire regulatory process is effectively driven, for the most part, by the distributors. And why is that the case? Because the distributors have the most to lose of anyone from anything that is going to threaten the status quo. The status quo gives them a privileged position with a limited amount of competition. It guarantees them that middleman position. And the result of the increasing concentration in that industry means that they are also relatively few in number, which perhaps counterintuitively gives them a great deal of political clout. In general, it's easier to organize a small group of people with very similar interests than it is to organize a very large group of people. It's easier to organize all the farmers than it is to organize all the consumers of food. And likewise, it's easier to organize the small number of distributors than it is to organize the very large number of consumers of alcoholic products, the very large number of vineyards in the United States, the very large number of brewers, and so on. And so the result is that you tend to get a policy that creates very concentrated benefits for a small group, that small group being the distributors, while spreading the costs out thinly among a very, very large group of people, that being the consumers. Now, on net, the costs outweigh the benefits. On net, it would be better if we had, better for consumers, if we were able to have greater competition at the distributor level, at the retail level. But the problem is that those benefits of deregulating are so incredibly spread out that it's not likely that those groups are going to be able to lobby effectively in their favor. I imagine most of you here are familiar with the recent wine shipping cases that were decided by the Supreme Court last spring. There were Swedenborg v. Kelly and Granholm v. Heels. I won't go into a long discussion of what was involved in those cases, but the main thing to realize is that those cases were a microcosm of the issues that I'm talking about here. What's really going on in those cases is the fact that distributors in states wanted to make sure that anybody shipping trying to ship goods from out of state had to go through them, had to go through the middleman of the distributor, as opposed to being able to go directly to retailers or directly to consumers. And this created a discriminatory impact. If you want to hear more about that, I'll be happy to talk about it in the Q&A period. The next thing to realize about regulatory reform is that while the distributors do tend to drive the process, in general, they are not going to want to be stating up front the bald economic interest which drives them to take that kind of position. So they need another set of arguments in order to gird their position. And these are what I usually refer to as the fig leaf justifications, the fig leaves that are designed to cover up the real economic motivations. They have to defend their privileged position by appealing to the public interest in some way or another. And in this process, they end up being assisted by the traditional advocates of temperance, who in the past have often been religious groups interested in any regulation that is going to restrict the consumption of alcohol, or more likely in the modern day, by the self-appointed health advocates who want people to adopt what they consider to be healthier lifestyles. So you end up with a kind of a paradox of sorts. We end up with firms whose primary business is purveying alcoholic products becoming among the most vocal advocates of temperance and alcoholic regulation and control. It seems a little bit odd. Why are the others who are involved in this industry at different levels, the suppliers and the retailers, why are they not pushing that kind of position for the most part? It is, for the most part, because of the fact that they don't have an additional economic interest that makes it in their interest to push for those particular kinds of public interest regulations or public interest arguments and justifications. So what I would urge you to do is realize that some of these public interest arguments may have validity, some of them may not, but you can't take them at face value because of the fact that those who are pushing them have different reasons for pushing them. Now, in that case, what you need to do is look at them with a jaundiced eye and realize that some of the regulations that we may be talking about are actually not going to be assisting in that process very much at all, and instead simply tend to drive up prices and inflate the profits of the middlemen. Now, I also want to address more specifically an issue that you've been facing here in Minnesota, but has also come up in some other states like New York, which is the issue of restricted competition at the retail level. We have other retail organizations, grocery stores, drug stores, and other establishments that would like to be able to compete against the liquor stores and other licensed retail outlets. Now, of course, this is not true in every state. In a number of states, you don't have this kind of restriction at the retail level. In California, where I'm from, I can walk into my local convenience store or drug store or grocery store and get virtually any kind of alcohol I'm looking for. But some states, such as this one, do have a more restricted amount of competition at the retail level. And Naturally, there are some people who would like to break into that market, such as the grocers. And what they have found, to their surprise, is that they are opposed not just by the existing retailers, there's no surprise there, but that they are opposed by the distributors as well. Now, initially, this poses a kind of economic puzzle, because there are actually prima facie reasons that distributors should actually favor greater competition at the retail level. And the foremost of these is the fact that the double markup issue would be reduced. Remember, distributors are harmed by the fact that retailers are able to charge a greater markup, because that reduces the total amount of alcohol sales that they would otherwise be able to make. So, looking at that alone, it would seem like the distributor should actually be in favor of a greater amount of competition at the retail level. So what's going on? Why is it that distributors are so united in their opposition to greater competition at the retail level? Well, I can't look into their minds. I can't say what's really going on, but I have four hypotheses about what's going on. So let me get those to you. The first of these hypotheses, and I think the most important of them, is very simply, they don't want to rock the regulatory boats. They are enormously benefited by the status quo. And anything that could potentially start to unravel that status quo is ultimately a threat to their economic well-being as they see it. If it's okay to have greater competition at the retail level, then why not greater competition at the wholesale level as well? Or why not begin to open up the market even more and allow direct contact between retailers and consumers and suppliers on the other end to possibly cut out the middleman entirely? They need to make sure that they defend that whole regulatory structure so they don't end up in a slippery slope situation, as they say it, where they end up losing the other protections that are afforded to them by the law. The second point to realize is that distributors don't want to create new entry points for new competitors. As it stands, existing distributors often have essentially a lock on existing retailers. But if you have new retailers opening up, there's the possibility that they could form contracts with new distribution companies, or perhaps just new companies that are established distribution companies but are new to the area, and that again means the possibility for opening up greater competition at the wholesale or distributor level. The third point is that they would also like, I surmise, to minimize their fixed delivery costs. If you have a small number of retailers that are selling a relatively large number of bottles each, that's relatively easier to service than if you have a much larger number of retailers selling a smaller number of bottles each. So what they can do is they can make sure by having less competition at the retail level, they simply have to go fewer places and they'll minimize their own cost of distribution by doing that. Fourth and finally, I think it's also possible that the distributors are worried that if they concede to having greater competition at the retail level, what they could do is accidentally create new political opponents. Currently, for instance, grocers who don't sell alcohol are probably not terribly concerned about the regulations that are in place throughout the country that gird the three-tier system or any of those undesirable effects. But once they are in the alcohol business, once they're selling alcohol, suddenly they could realize that actually they're being harmed by the very large markups that are charged by the distributors. And that could give them a political incentive to start to lobby for further change. So they could become a potent future political force to be reckoned with. So it's possible that they are, in other words, concerned with creating another special interest or empowering another special interest that could be as powerful as their own. Putting it all together, I think the point here is to realize that we have a system of alcohol regulation in this country that gives some groups inordinate amounts of market power. Those are usually the distributors and, in some cases, protected retailers as well. Consumers would be benefited in both in terms of price and in variety and in convenience by allowing greater competition at all of these levels. But the problem is that those same beneficiaries of the existing system have every reason to resist, tooth and nail, anything that might threaten the status quo. And I stand open to your questions. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Whitman. You spoke of the double markup issue and how all three tiers have to, I guess, deal with it, and the retailer's ability to increase prices, and that would decrease potentially sales. Could you spend some time on the demand elasticity of alcohol products? Is it different for beer than it is for wine, than it is for liquor? And at what point do people drop off and not purchase alcohol?
Chairman, Representative, it's an excellent question. I can't claim to be able to give you really specific numbers and as a response to that. I really don't know how different the demand elasticities are. I can tell you this much. In general, it tends to be the case that the consumers who are most inelastic, most unresponsive to price, also tend to be the consumers who are the heaviest drinkers of alcohol. So for that reason, what that means is, in general, when you have price hikes, the people who are most likely to reduce their consumption will actually tend to be your moderate drinkers, people who are just buying wine to put on the table at dinner, not people who are out late at night, getting drunk and potentially going out and creating a danger on the road. Now, extending that to the issue of wine versus beer versus spirits, for that reason, I would expect, this is just a guess, but I would expect that we probably have more inelastic demand for spirits, more elastic demand in the case of beer and wine.
Okay, and if I can follow up, and throughout the United States, you're mentioning about the national regulatory structure, I guess. Throughout the United States, there are several and large expanses of sparsely populated areas, and in relation to changes that might be proposed, how would they manifest themselves in rural areas where distances are great, and if the distributor or wholesaler of a certain size isn't able to be maintained, will those sparsely populated liquor consumption points be affected?
Right. I expect that you would see your biggest effect in urban areas which are capable of supporting a larger number of retailers. In those rural areas, it depends essentially on how far people are willing to travel. So if it's the case that generally people are not willing to travel and you're not able to support as many retailers, that's where you're going to see the smallest effect. You might even see very little effect at all. I don't think it's going to make things worse, allowing greater competition. The worst case scenario is things stay the way that they are in some areas, and then in other areas where there's this possibility for greater competition because you have a large enough market to support it, in those areas that's where you'd be likely to see the reduction in price, improvements in convenience, and so on.
Okay, one more. So Budweiser, Budweiser would like to deal as a supplier, so they would like to deal with more wholesalers and distributors, potentially? Or would it be like Sierra Nevada who would like to?
Right. In the case of your biggest producers, generally, they are the ones who are least concerned, least worried about their product not being carried. There's just no chance that a beer distributor is not going to want to carry Miller or Coors or Bud. But on the other hand, when you're talking about your microbrews or you're talking about small wineries, these are the producers who are the most harmed by the current system because of the fact that they have such limited opportunities for going elsewhere. They don't necessarily have another distributor that they would be able to go to because of the small amount of competition in that sector. They often don't have the opportunity to sell directly to retailers or directly to consumers, so they have no option but to go through a distributor. So those are the ones whose oxes are gored most by the current system.
No problem.
Representative Emmer, any questions? Dr. Whitman, I have a question. In one of the cities that I represent in Chanhassen, we have a grocery store. In Minnesota, you can't sell liquor in the grocery store, but you can have it connected as long as they're separated by a wall or in the case of Bioleys, a glass door, so that you have to, if you go there to buy groceries, you go and you pay for that, and then if you want to get wine or whatever, you can go right next door and you have to make a separate purchase. Is that found in any other states that you know of?
Mr. Chairman, I'm really not certain. I wouldn't be surprised at all to find out that that was the case, particularly other states that have similar regulations to this one. But I really can't speak to that specifically.
Okay. Do you know off the top of your head how many states have, like California, where there are no controls or very few controls?
It's hard to draw any generalizations because of the fact that it's such an idiosyncratic system. Every state has its own regulations, and you can't simply array them on a spectrum from the most closed to the most open. Instead, you'll find that some are more open in one regard and less open in other regards. So, for instance, I actually grew up in Texas. In Texas, you can get beer just about anywhere. But on the other hand, wine and spirits more strict, and generally you're going to end up going to a liquor store to get that kind of thing. I believe that California does tend to occupy the sort of the most liberal end of the spectrum to the extent that you can draw a spectrum like that, but I couldn't tell you how many others are that similar to it.
And then one last question. Do you know if there are any other states, or if there are, how many other states are now looking at liberalizing the system that they have now with the three levels, the wholesale or the producers, the wholesalers, and the distributors, or the distributors and the retailers?
Chairman, I wish I could give you more specific numbers. You sound like you're looking for numbers on these questions.
I'm just curious.
And unfortunately, I can't give you that. I can tell you that this is a bubbling issue all over the country, and I've been contacted by numerous interest parties in other states because of the book that I wrote. And so, and generally, who I get contacted by are either journalists or by people at the retail end who are interested in seeing, in some way, the market get opened up a little bit more. I know that in Texas, that's one place where they're considering, in some way or another, reforming their laws. I believe in Washington, they're considering reforming their laws. But it takes a different form in every state because of the fact that the laws are so idiosyncratic. So, for instance, the debate that you're having here about the possibility of opening up the retail end to grocers, that's a debate you're seeing take place here and in New York, but you're not seeing it take place in a lot of other places because of the fact that not many places have that particular kind of regulation. There are a lot of states that are more open at the retail end, but they're much more restrictive in the distributor sector. So you see the action taking place in a different aspect of the industry in other places.
Okay. Any other questions? With that, Dr. Whitman, thank you very much for coming and testifying. We appreciate it. It was very enlightening and interesting. With that, I think we are adjourned.
You were going to leave any opportunity for the other members?
Wait, Brian says we might not be adjourned.
You want to open up?
If there's anybody else, we have more time. If there's anybody else that wants to speak on this issue or on the other side, feel free. See nobody? Then we are adjourned. Thanks, Dave.
Okay.
Yeah. Bob Uloff, and then we'll hear from some citizens and some concerns of either the energy bill or just some of the heating and energy cost issues that we're all aware of and experiencing to varying degrees. And also what's going on in the utility world of especially with the conservation improvement program that we have in Minnesota and ways to help in the heating costs. And then wrap it up with a quick recap of some cell phone legislation that we passed out of this committee and through the legislature a couple of years ago. Was challenged in court, and Mr. Uloff, at the appropriate time, will give us an update on that, as well as some more discussions on some telecom issues. So that's kind of the roadmap to today, and we'll start with probably about a half-hour presentation from Mr. Uloff on the federal energy bill. I think there's a raging question. We can ask it during the middle. Otherwise, save your questions. We'll ask Bob at the time. But if there's a certain subject area, we can take some questions throughout if we don't get too many questions going and get ourselves way off track. So with that, Mr. Uloff, thanks for your work on reviewing some of this. And tell us what did the federal government pass relating to the energy and renewable issues and nuclear and any other aspect that we might be interested in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Energy Policy Act of 2005 is the first major
piece of energy legislation that's been enacted by Congress since 1992. Maybe that's one reason why it's 1,725 pages long. This little tome here. The Act contains about 300 separate sections, and it authorizes spending of about $88 billion over the next 10 years, according to one source, and also contains about $14.5 billion in tax incentives. It addresses every existing energy source and some that as yet still reside in scientific laboratories. And much of what's going to come out of this Act to kind of set the stage for energy policy over the next few years still awaits the writing of regulations by various federal agencies in more than 250 separate rulemakings that the Act mandates. And those will flesh out a little bit more some of what's in the Act itself. In other words, I'm saying there's a lot of what's in here that we're not going to know yet for a little bit. Preparing this presentation was made much easier by the publication of summaries of key provisions of this Act by many trade associations and nonprofit organizations who track energy issues in Washington. There are some handouts in your packet produced. There's one produced by the Extension Energy Program at Washington State University, this one that I think the audience may also have access to, that contains a list of several dozen websites that contain summaries of the Act authored by a wide range of organizations, many of which have been very useful to me, and they can provide you with more detail on specific parts of the Act. Also in your packet are two documents produced by the National Regulatory Research Institute in Washington. One, they're both entitled Summary of the Energy Policy Act. One is specifically the electricity section of the Act. Those are also very, very helpful. There are some other documents in your packet that I'll refer to when I get to those. Clearly, to try to accurately summarize an act of this scope would take longer than the time devoted to this hearing and longer than any of you would be willing to listen. I tried to focus on those issues that are most relevant to Minnesota based on legislation that we have enacted or discussed here in the past couple of years. But I'm afraid any discussion of highlights of such a long bill is going to degenerate into a bit of a recitation of a laundry list, so I ask your forgiveness in advance. But I hope at the end of the presentation we'll at least know a little bit about what's in here, and if you're interested in going into depth on any specific topics, I'd be happy to do that. I guess the first thing I'd like to start off with is talking about electricity. Last session, we passed an omnibus energy bill, Chapter 97, I believe, that had a lot of provisions in it regarding electricity. The PUC was instructed to take into account regional need when conducting certificate of need procedures. We also transferred the siting and routing responsibilities for high voltage transmission lines from the Environmental Quality Board to the Public Utilities Commission, and also created a working group that was to look at streamlining the transmission approval process further. And a lot of those issues have been addressed here in the Federal Energy Act itself. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is Section 1221, which essentially gives the federal government some way to enter into certificate of need decisions for high voltage transmission lines at the state level. And what this provision does is give the Secretary of the Federal Department of Energy the authority to designate certain areas national interest electric transmission corridors. And in doing that, the Secretary is to look at three items. One, whether the economic vitality of the corridor or the end markets it serves may be constrained due to lack either of adequate supply of electricity or to reasonable prices of electricity. Second, whether economic growth in that corridor or, again, the end markets it serves may be jeopardized by reliance on limited energy sources and whether supply diversification might be a benefit. Finally, the Secretary is to consider whether the designation would serve U.S. energy independence, be in the interest of national energy policy, and enhance national defense and homeland security. If such a designation is made, the federal government is authorized to issue a construction permit for an interstate high-voltage transmission line if a state has not issued one within a year after a permit application has been filed, or it has conditioned its approval so that construction is not either economically feasible or will not significantly reduce congestion. So this enables the federal government to step in if the state government is taking a long time in making its decision
I know we spoke last session about the fact that one of the reasons that a lot of transmission lines haven't been built in recent years is that the state process takes a longer amount of time than possible. This allows the federal government to step in and deal with that. It's interesting, looking away from electricity for a second, that similar kinds of provisions are in this bill with respect to other energy sources. Under one section, the governor can request that the state enter into a cooperative agreement with the EPA regarding permitting of an oil refinery. Because another thing that we've noticed, especially since the Katrina hurricane disaster, is that we haven't built a lot of refineries in the U.S. in recent years. One of the reasons people say, again, is cumbersome state permitting processes. And the EPA is authorized to actually provide money to states to hire personnel to help with permits through that proceeding. Another section allows the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, again with respect to natural gas, to actually coordinate hearings and rules and procedures when there's an application for a certificate for essentially public convenience and necessity under the Natural Gas Act, and establish a schedule for all the authorizations, both federal and state, that are going to occur, and all state agencies must comply with that schedule. So I think what we see here is that in electricity, in natural gas, and also with respect to oil refineries, the federal government is beginning to allow itself to step in and hurry state processes along if they're not running so quickly. I should also add under that that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission also now has the exclusive right to approve or deny applications for the construction or expansion of liquefied natural gas port facilities. And this has happened in the even while suits were being filed by the California Public Utilities Commission against FERC regarding the siting of a, such a facility in California. And the state of Rhode Island has also sued a liquid natural gas company that wants to put a port in that state. So again, feds are saying we can enter into it here.
Mr. Roloff, yeah, just you mentioned FERC, and I trust most people know what that stands for. I'm just going to say it. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, just so we don't lose some of our own committee members or people in the audience.
There are quite a few acronyms in
right,
the back.
Right, right. So.
Okay. Keeping to the topic of transportation in electricity, the commission also issued, is ordered by the Act to issue a rule within 1 year after the Act passed to establish incentive-based rate treatments for transmission facilities as a way of promoting capital investment to either enlarge or improve these facilities. Part of that rule must also talk about providing higher rates of return to attract investment and providing for cost recovery of complying with mandatory electric reliability standards. So again, it's another attempt by the federal government to try to hurry up the building of electric transmission lines. Another way the Act does that is one of its tax incentive provisions. It shortens the recovery period for certain transmission assets from the current 20 to 15 years for transmission lines that come into service after April 2005. And that's been estimated to cost the Federal Treasury approximately $1.5 billion over the next 10 years. We've also talked about transmission lines in rural areas here in Minnesota. The Act does provide $20 million a year through the year 2012 for grants to local units of government, cooperatives, or nonprofits in rural areas with less than 10,000 inhabitants to either increase the energy efficiency of transmission lines or to help with siting and upgrading those lines, both transmission and distribution lines, or modernizing electric generating facilities that serve rural areas. Preference is to be given to renewable energy facilities. A moment ago, I mentioned the topic of electric reliability, which has been of great concern lately, as the system, which hasn't had a lot of transmission built, and as demand for electricity increases, we've seen an increase in the number of outages that occur in various places around the country. There is no requirement, no federal requirement, that essentially that for reliability right now. Anything done under reliability by utilities is done strictly voluntarily. There is an organization called the North American Electric Reliability Council that has drafted, in consultation with utilities, a number of measures to increase reliability, but as to now, all those measures have been voluntary. What this act does is create a national energy entity called the Electric Reliability Organizations that states and utilities will have to contend with, because it makes it's going to make its own rules regarding reliability and have the ability to enforce them, subject to review by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And if that NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Council, has applied to be the Electronic Reliability Organization, that will establish and enforce standards for the bulk power system, which includes utilities, independent power producers, and even utilities not otherwise subject to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, such as co-ops and munis. The ERO will be allowed to charge and collect fees from end users for its administrative costs, and it can also impose penalties for violations of any reliability standards, up to $1 million a day. It will also have authority to delegate some responsibilities regarding reliability to regional organizations that have as yet don't exist. One thing the ERO cannot do is require construction, though, of either generation or transmission facilities.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Yoloff, what section is that in?
That is section 1211.
Thank you.
Sure. Moving on, Mr. Chair. The Act also repeals a statute in effect since 1935, I believe, the Public Utilities Holding Company Act, which barred registered holding companies from acquiring or merging with utilities that were not interconnected as a single entity, preventing a company from owning, for example, utilities in California and New York, separated as that. It also lifts regulations that prohibited companies from acquiring more than a 10% stake in any regulated utility. I think the likely impact of this is to see an increase in mergers and acquisitions in the utility fields. State regulators will retain the ability or any authority to approve mergers involving parents of the regulated utilities. One thing we may also want to watch out for is merged companies may divest generation in order to avoid horizontal market power, and we already saw that occur with a merger between Exelon and Pacific Gas and Electric. That resulted in the divestiture of some 6,000 megawatts of generating capacity. Other companies may also divest generation, and also we've seen transmission assets may also be spun off, as happened in another recent merger. So that certainly bears some watching.
Mr. Eloff, that was new language allowed under this bill?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Mr. Kinnear.
The 10%, so what you're saying is current law only allowed utility to... explain that a little bit more.
My understanding is current law allows investment in regulated utilities of no more than 10%
by another company.
Right. That percentage is now lifted.
So Bob Eloff Inc. could only buy 10% of Xcel
right.
Energy.
Now I can buy Xcel outright. Yes.
I see.
No plan to do so.
Okay. Thanks.
Let me talk some about renewable energy, because that's something we're all interested in here in Minnesota. The renewable energy production credit, which allows 1.8 cents a kilowatt hour for the first 10 years of production, which has been applied to wind, solar, and other renewable energies, was extended through the end of 2007, which gives some measure of at least short-term stability. You may recall, members of the committee may recall a bill we passed last session to extend the state incentive payment because the federal payment had gone into abeyance. That is now going to be extended through December 31st of 2007. Also, the Act expands the number of technologies that are eligible for those payments to include landfill gas, livestock methane, and ocean energies. They all now qualify for that incentive payment.
Livestock gas, methane digesters wouldn't have been qualified prior?
They did in the past, and now they are qualified.
They did not in the past.
Right. At least through the end of 2007, they're qualified.
Okay.
One thing that was in the Senate-passed version, which did not survive conference committee, was a renewable portfolio standard, similar to the one we have here and maybe 20 other states have, requiring a certain proportion of electricity be generated by renewable sources by a certain date. As I said, that did not survive the conference committee, but the federal government itself has instituted its own renewable portfolio standard. In 2006, 3% of the electricity that the federal government purchases must come from renewables, and that amount goes up to 7.5% in the year 2013. I think something else that will be of interest to people here in Minnesota is a new financial instrument called Clean Renewable Energy Bonds that can be issued by any unit of government, municipal cooperatives. It provides the borrower with an interest-free loan, and the holder of the bonds doesn't get paid interest. The holder of the bonds gets a tax credit in an amount that's intended to provide an after-tax return equal to a comparable tax investment. To qualify, at least 95% of the proceeds of the bonds must be used for capital expenditures. Wind, biomass, geothermal, solar, and hydro technologies are eligible. And those bonds can be issued anytime in 2006 or 2007 in an amount up to $800 million, which is going to be allocated to states by or to sellers by the Secretary of the Treasury. $300 million of that is reserved for the use by electric cooperatives. Homeowners and small business owners can receive rebates of up to 25% or $3,000 for installing renewable energy systems in their homes or small businesses. Another change of a federal statute, this act amends the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, known as PURPA, which required utilities to purchase energy from small, mostly renewable power producers based on the utility's avoided costs. The thought at the time was there was not much competition in many areas, so utilities had to be required to purchase that energy. Now, with more wholesale competition in the market, there's no longer an obligation to buy on the part of utilities if they can show that the sellers have non-discriminatory access to wholesale markets and also can get transmission interconnection services under an open access transmission tariff. FERC issued a notice of rulemaking on January 19th, and they made the initial determination that renewable energy producers selling to utilities in Minnesota, or actually in the entire MISO, Midwestern Independent System Organization, of which Minnesota is a part, it's a regional organization that Minnesota belongs to, any renewable producer in that numerous state entity, they're saying you do face competitive competitions. Utilities are not required to buy. The commission is also supposed to issue regulations that allow utilities to pass prudently incurred costs of purchasing power from these facilities, no longer referring strictly to avoided costs. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out in the marketplace. There's about $2 billion in this act over the next 10 years for biomass, and it's largely directed towards dealing with transportation issues. The act encourages the development and use of biomass-based fuels. It gives some incentives for an infrastructure to actually deliver those fuels to consumers. It helps to propel the technologies for the vehicles to use those fuels, and it also provides some incentives for consumers to actually purchase those vehicles. Obviously, ethanol is of great interest here in Minnesota, and while the Act did not propose a renewable portfolio standard, it did propose what I guess you might call a renewable fuel standard. It requires that at least 4 billion gallons of ethanol and biodiesel fuel be used in 2006, which represents about 3% of transportation fuels this year, and that increase from 4 billion gallons this year to 7.5 billion gallons by the year 2012. And EPA is to establish additional percentages after that year. EPA will promulgate rules that apply to refineries, blenders, distributors, and importers regarding these. And beginning in 2013, that percentage must also include a separate element that calls for at least 250 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol, which is made from agricultural residues, woody biomass, switchgrass, and also municipal solid waste. One interesting thing here for refiners in the Midwest, there is also established a credit trading program for ethanol, and I think it's to be expected that Midwestern refineries, which kind of have had a head start on the rest of the country, will over-comply with their minimum, and that they'll be able to sell credits to refiners in other parts of the country who haven't started manufacturing ethanol much here. So I think that will be an additional boon to the ethanol cooperatives around the state. A few other things the Act did with respect to ethanol. There is a credit for 10 cents a gallon for up to 15 million gallons production, and that applied to, this applies both to ethanol and to biodiesel plants. Current law allowed that credit to be used by any producer that made less than 30 million gallons a year. That has been increased to 60 million gallons a year through 2008, so there may be some additional ethanol plants here in Minnesota that can take advantage of that 10% credit. The Act also attempted to make sure that there's an infrastructure out there so that consumers can purchase ethanol and biodiesel at the gasoline retail level. It established a 30% federal income credit up to a maximum of $30 for the installation of gas of a pump that will allow either E85 to be pumped or biodiesel up to 20%, liquefied natural gas, propane, and hydrogen. And that credit, the 30% credit, extends through the year 2010.
How much was that again?
It was $30,000 for the cost of the pump up to, or I'm sorry, it's 30% of the cost of the pump up to a maximum of $30,000.
Would that work for a hydrogen refueling station too? Is that
famous? Yes, hydrogen is eligible.
Okay.
Yeah. I mentioned a moment ago a term I don't think I've heard mentioned in this committee in the last couple of years, cellulosic biomass, which also can produce ethanol. It's the same ethanol as we make now from corns and soybeans, but it uses different feedstocks and processes. Cellulosic biomass can be produced from agricultural plant waste, such as corn stover or cereal straw. It can also be produced from industrial waste, such as sawdust and paper pulp, which we have a fair amount of here in Minnesota, and also energy crops that have grown for fuel, such as switchgrass. The problem with cellulosic biomass so far has been a technological one, that the sugars that are locked in cellulose are locked in complex carbohydrates. They're very, very hard to break down. And much of the research so far has been looking for various enzymes to break down those sugars and allow them to be fermented, just like we do with corn-based ethanol. One of the benefits of cellulosic biomass is that, according to a life cycle analysis done in a national laboratory, is that the greenhouse gas emissions are 80% less than for gasoline, compared with 20-30% less for corn ethanol. The main difference being that heat is used in the process, fossil fuel heat is used to heat the grain during the conversion process for ethanol, and wouldn't be necessary if we were successful in finding an enzyme to break down the sugars in cellulosic biomass. There's a good deal of support for further development of this process. There's a $1.4 billion from 2006 through 2008 as a loan guarantee and grant program to actually construct facilities to make biomass, cellulosic biomass, or from municipal solid waste. DOE is also establishing an incentive program for the first billion gallons of cellulosic biofuels. They would set payments for the first 100 million gallons, and then you'd have a reverse auction looking for competitive bids with incentives awarded to the lowest bidder. And those are the $250 million of incentives along those lines. Research to look for enzymes that will help break down this matter will receive a total of about $380 million through the year 2015. And there are also grants to help look for innovations for pre-processing feedstocks for cellulosic biomass. That's $50 million through the year 2010. Regarding other types of biomass we use here in Minnesota, there are also grants to improve the commercial value of forest biomass that's used for electricity or heat or transportation fuels, and the Act authorizes $50 million a year through the year 2016, with the maximum grant being $500,000. I should mention, and I think I've stated it when I talk about dollar amounts, the Act authorizes dollar amounts, which are a maximum. The Congress still has to appropriate dollar amounts, and we found out that sometimes they appropriate a lot less than is authorized. I've been speaking about transportation, and the chair mentioned hydrogen in vehicles. There's also a great deal of support from that. There are grants to increase hydrogen production, storage, and distribution of about $1 billion through the year 2010. There are grants to further along the process of developing fuel cells, about $860 million through 2010. And there are about $1.3 billion for demonstration projects for hydrogen vehicles, also going through the year 2010. There's also support for dual fuel and hybrid vehicles. There are grants to improve the technologies for hybrid flex fuel vehicles or plug-in flex fuel vehicles, about $40 million through 2009. There's also money authorized to encourage the production and sales of hybrids and advanced diesel vehicles, but it just says money is authorized. It doesn't say exactly how much. There is also a grant program of $200 million that's designed to make 30 grants to states, cities, and metropolitan transit authorities that want to acquire alternate fuel or fuel cell vehicles, and also ultra-low sulfur diesel vehicles, which would include both passenger vehicles, buses, or delivery vehicles. This money can also be used to acquire or install infrastructure necessary to support these vehicles, and the grants can pay up to 50% of the cost, with a maximum grant being about $15 million. So it may be something of interest to cities in Minnesota. There are also consumer rebates for the hybrid vehicles to help convince consumers to purchase them. One of the handouts in your packet, which is a table like this, was put out by the American Committee on for an Energy Efficient Economy, estimates the tax credits that would accrue to a large number of different light-duty vehicle tax credits. The interesting thing about this is that and these are effective beginning January 2006. They differ from previous federal incentives for consumers in that they're actual tax credits rather than deductions, so that consumers can get the full dollar value of the credit. And they're based, the provision is structured so that vehicles earn credits for both achieving greater fuel economy and for actually saving fuels. So as this table shows, I think that the maximum credit on this table is $3,600. You also, there's a column here titled Emissions Pass Fail. It is required that the vehicle be able to pass certain emissions tests, which I'm told all diesel vehicles so far have failed to pass. But the total amounts of credit run from $250 to about $3,600, as I mentioned. And I believe these credits go through the year 2008. The Act talks also and provides some funds for energy efficiency. The federal government actually sets energy efficiency standards for a number of products, fluorescent lights, ceiling fans, vending machines, traffic signals, etc. And it requires the Department of Energy to set standards of its own for other products, including commercial air conditioning and heating equipment, commercial refrigerators, and freezers. It also allows for an appliance rebate program at the state level. The federal funds would match up to 50% of any state funds that are issued as rebates to residential consumers who purchase Energy Star appliances. And those that match is authorized at $50 million a year through the year 2010.
Mr. Eloff, does that have to be state money, or can that be money that utilities in our state put towards those, through our SIP program?
I don't know for sure, Mr. Chair, but I would expect it could be utility money, because all they're saying is we'll match 50%, get the money from somewhere else. I'll check on that,
though. Okay. Check on that. Let me know.
There are also tax credits for homeowners. There's another table put out by the ACEEE that has a very small type, but it lists a whole host of tax credits that consumers can get for introducing ground source heat pumps, efficient water heaters, gas furnaces and boilers, windows, and appliances such as energy-efficient refrigerators. Usually, looks like the amounts are up to about $300. There's a significant amount of support going to the coal industry, looking for advanced and cleaner ways of producing coal. Section 401 authorizes about $1.8 billion through the year 2014 for what are called the Clean Coal Power Initiatives. There's also support for existing coal facilities to install advanced pollution control equipment or processes, $500 million through 2010. And there's also an investment tax credit for those who invest in clean coal facilities. It's 20% for integrated gas combined cycle plants. And there's $800 million in credits that the Secretary of Treasury can allocate for them, 15% for other advanced kinds of coal, and 20% for any gasification plants that are done by specific industries, $350 million available for that. Yes, sir.
Is that coal, any of that coal incentives, is that any of that directed or related to the project on the range that we've had?
There is a loan guarantee for an advanced integrated gasification combined cycle plant located in the Upper Great Plains, mentioned in the act, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Figuring that that's probably what it's about.
Right.
The nuclear industry received from the Act a production tax credit for advanced nuclear power facilities, looking at the next generation, of 1.8 cents per kilowatt hour for 8 years, and that's up to 6,000 megawatts of capacity. I know we're going to have testifiers later today speaking about energy assistance. The Act authorizes low-income heat assistance at $5.1 billion a year for the next 3 years. That's up from $2 billion a year in 2004. As I said before, authorization does not necessarily mean that's how much money will be appropriated. I'm sure the other testifiers will speak to that. The Act also authorizes states to purchase renewable fuels for LIHEAP customers, which is something that is new. With respect to weatherization assistance, the authorization is for $500 million in 2006, $600 million in 2007, and $700 million in 2008. One thing that the Act does, again, another tax incentive, this time for natural gas, it reduces the depreciation period over which natural gas distribution lines from current 20 to 15 years. And again, that's expected to result in about $1.6 billion over the next 10 years from the Federal Treasury. Mr. Chair, there's another handout that has a pie chart on one side and a table on the other side. This comes from the House Ways and Means Committee of Congress. The pie chart, as I mentioned, there are $14.5 billion of tax incentives in this bill. The pie chart allocates them out to the various energy sources, the largest one being renewable electricity, most of which is the renewable production incentive that I talked about earlier. If you turn to the table, it gives a list of what some of the larger specific tax incentives under the bill are. The two I mentioned, the change in from 20 to 15 years over which how transmission, electric transmission property is treated, and the same with natural gas distribution lines are in here. There are a number of others, obviously going through all fuel sources, that again resulting in $14.5 billion worth of tax incentives. That concludes my summary, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to have taken you through it so quickly, but there's a lot in this bill. There's a lot I haven't spoken to, but at least I think you're a little bit more aware now of what's in there. And as I said, I'd be happy to follow up on anything.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eloff, one short question. You talked about the 1.8 cent renewable energy credit.
Yes.
Is that for new generation facilities, or can existing facilities qualify for that?
Well, there is an existing 1.8 cent credit for facilities. The problem is that this credit had lapsed for about 10 months, and this reauthorized it, extending out to the end of 2007. So,
Mr. Chairman? However, they did add on some other types of renewable energy
that are eligible to receive the credit. Yes.
Right. Now, do they have to be new, or can existing, for instance, landfill gas, can existing facilities qualify for that credit?
I understand your question. I don't know the answer. That's something I'd like to check on.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. The nuclear part, you talked about 1.8 cent tax credit on that. Explain that a little more. Is that on new nuclear plants, new style nuclear plants? What is that? What is that?
Let me take a look in the act, Mr. Chair, to make sure. It's for plants that are placed into service after the act was enacted and before the year 2021. So it's new plants.
So it's a new plant.
Yes.
Okay. Any limit on that?
The limit is for 6,000 megawatts total capacity.
Okay. All right. So, any other questions? Otherwise, we'll bring up some of the testifiers today. Mr. Eloff, if you could just follow up with those couple questions we had as a committee, and committee members have questions further on this, certainly feel free to talk to Mr. Eloff and get more detail. But thanks for your overview and work on pulling this together. So.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Is Pam Marshall here, and I guess some others that are coming with you? If you all want to come up, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Good morning. You can identify yourself and give me, there's a few with you. What would be your wish in going through your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to defer until you hear from Mr. Tobin, Ms. Anderson, and Mr. Fearing. And then I plan to go and Mr. Elwood and then Mr. Huff from AARP.
Okay. Why don't you proceed how you would work for you. Try to keep this within a half hour with knowing that some questions will be coming as well. But please identify yourself for the record, each individual person and the group they represent, or if a private citizen, just so the chair has it. And, your name again?
John Skubish.
John? Okay, go ahead.
Born and raised on the east side of St. Paul. I'm on the horn on the east side of St. Paul now. I bought that about 25 years ago. And I be having my 81st birthday in May. I don't work much anymore, but my total monthly budget is $922 a month, and my total income from Social Security is $983. And I do get some energy help from October to January from Ramsey Action, and then I get $17 a month from Energy Sense. But the energy could be going up, and I'm paying $145 a month now on the budget, but that's been a chance to go up to maybe close to $200, $195 anyway. And with what little I have left for my Social Security after I get through my budget for the month, there's not much left to pay anymore. So I don't... what I'm going to do if it goes up that high. I'm lucky my house is paid for, but if I didn't have the house paid for, I would really be in big trouble now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Anderson wants to go next.
Okay, you, that's fine. Just please identify her. Identify yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Colleen Anderson.
Colleen?
Colleen.
Okay.
My husband Craig and I have three children, and we live in Wiper Lake. My husband works construction, which is seasonal. So a lot of times we have to rely on unemployment in the winter. We're very conservative, keeping our heat at 62 degrees, and we utilize our fireplace for heat. Our bills still range from $125 to $300 a month. Such large fluctuation in our energy bills make it hard to keep up. Minnesota cold weather rule states that you cannot be shut off during from October 15th through April 15th. So we try to budget, make payments, and still it's hard to keep up. Once April 15th comes, if our bill is not current, Xcel Energy is in the position to turn us off. And in fact, we've been in that position before. When I called Xcel to find out how to get turned back on, they suggest a large down payment and a monthly payment plan. One I knew we couldn't possibly do. And missing one of the payments would result only in being turned back off again. My husband and I sit down and we try to figure out what we're going to do. Borrowing money doesn't seem to make sense. That would only leave us with another payment that we can't possibly make. So what would you do? You know, you have your car insurance, house payment, water, phone, and all of them are important. They're all necessities. So I made some phone calls and I found out about two programs Minnesota offers. Energy Assistance Program and the Power On Program. You receive assistance based on your family size and income. We received $400 in 2005 from Energy Assistance Program, and it was applied directly to our energy bill, or to Xcel Energy, and it lasts about 4 months. And we're hoping to receive that same amount again this year, but with the rising cost of energy, we don't expect $400 to last through the 4 months. Energy assistance is a great program, but the amount of assistance doesn't only last a short time. That's why the Power On program is so important. Power On is not just a temporary fix, but a solution. The Power On program considered our monthly income and proposed a budget. 3% of our income will go towards our Xcel bill. They also offer a $40 credit, which is then subtracted from your monthly bill, which left us with a manageable payment to get through the winter months and keep us from being shut off on April 15th. Together, these two programs work and help us provide for our families and without cutting necessities. Energy assistance is a great start, but the Power On program is vital, and together, they're a Minnesota must. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, any questions, members?
Hello, I'm Pat Fearing. I live in St.
Yeah. Okay, welcome to everybody.
Welcome, thank you. I live in St. Paul. I am a single parent, have three daughters. As I've tried to fix, I put a new boiler in a couple of years ago, that really helped my energy costs. We kind of cut them in half. But this year, my energy costs have been double. Like normally, my energy costs would be about $250, $300 in a bad winter. My last month's bill was about $700. I have a fairly big house. I have a four-bedroom house, about 2,700 square feet. But it's an older home in St. Paul, and it needs windows. The furnace helped a lot, but I've got all my windows covered with plastic. But the way the costs have went up, they've increased about 40 to 50%. I'm a maintenance man, handyman, and my busy season is from spring till fall. So during the winter, it's a real slow season. So what happens is the Energy On program allows me to keep my home heated, and then when I get my taxes back in the spring, they usually all go to pay up my NSP bill. So if it wasn't for the Energy On program or the grant, my taxes wouldn't even cover them. This way, at least, I'm able to get close to zeroing it out in the spring. with the grant and keep my heat on in the winter.
Is it Pat?
Yes.
Two questions. The Energy On program, could you explain a little more about what that is? And I'm not particularly familiar with
it. I found out about it from when I became a single parent, and I also became a single income at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go to the food shelf, and I had to go to places, other resources to find money to help pay my keep my energy on, so it wasn't shut off in the middle of the winter, and that's how I got referred to the Energy On program.
Mr. Chair, if I might...
go ahead, Pat or Pam.
Yeah, actually the Energy Sense Coalition does administer what we've called the Power On program, and it began as a five-year pilot co-administered with Xcel that limited the percentage of income that participants had to devote to both gas and electric costs. As a result of a change in legislation, I think it was two years ago or last year, but that subsidy and discount off of monthly bills is now limited to electricity, but it is meant to complement the federal energy assistance program that is primarily a heating program. What the Power On program does is basically make an electric bill more affordable on an ongoing basis. And the assumption is, therefore, people are able to pay more regularly and remain connected to service, particularly in the spring at the close of the cold weather rule period.
So, is there money put into that? Is it utility money, non-profit, private money, or is there some state money that they also access?
Mr. Chair, members, the bill is an Xcel-only program. It is funded by Xcel. It was the before it changed into a program that was primarily modeled on household energy burden and lowering the percentage of income devoted, it was the straightforward Xcel discount rate for anyone who was an energy assistance customer of Xcel's.
Okay. So the customer receives an energy discount if they qualify based on their income?
That's correct, and on their consumption.
But Xcel is the only one that does it in our state, or do others do it as well?
No, Xcel is the only one that has that kind of program.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question didn't start when the state decided that Governor Flynn's administration decided that he was going to put $17 million worth of HANF money into added onto the federal energy assistance money. They also had a couple other things in there that SIP funding would go through and check a person's furnace to see if they can improve that, windows, air insulation. Did you avail yourself of any of those programs, Pat?
What happened was I had a 100-year-old furnace, and a couple years ago that went out. I went down to do some laundry, and my basement was filled with carbon monoxide, and I called Ramsey Action Program. They came out and condemned, basically turned off my furnace and gave me some portable heaters and replaced my furnace.
Mr. Chairman,
and then my energy costs went way down, because before that they were high because my old furnace was so inefficient. The heat exchanger wasn't working and the air exchanger wasn't working. And so they replaced it. My energy costs went down to where they were, you know, about $300 a month, $325. And then this year they just skyrocketed up.
It's my understanding that this year, along with putting the TAF money in the energy system, we also made it that we could use conservation enhancement money to check your windows and your insulation. Have you heard of that program yet?
I've not heard of the program. I just have... purchased some new windows, and I'm going to purchase some new laundry windows because my house is real old and the windows are single pane, and they're old. They rattle, so I have to put the shrink wrap on them every year.
You wouldn't know what to do if you get that all fixed.
Oh, that's going to be like heaven, yeah. I'll be able to really cut my costs.
I think Mr. Marshall probably knows about what the programs I'm talking about and certainly can give you information that maybe can assist you in that.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, if I might, yes, there was $13 million in TANF money, and I get to that in my testimony. It's my understanding that the department is working with the utilities to do accelerated SIP funding so that we can put more money toward insulating people's homes, and that there has been a slight increase in the number of furnace replacements that can be done under the SIP program. There was also, and I'm sure the department will talk about this, an emergency repair and replacement program that goes hand in hand with the federal LIHEAP program, but like all of the funding for every one of those programs we just mentioned, the need for it far outstrips the available resources, and that's part of what I'll talk about when I testify here.
Any other questions for the witness? Otherwise, to follow up on Representative Gunther's point, I think that it's possible you could qualify for some what they call SIP Conservation Improvement Program.
I will look
thank you. And so there might even be some people here in the audience that could connect with you.
Okay.
But it would work. And my question was going to be, have you used any of those matching dollars or rebates to help improve the energy efficiency?
No, I didn't know they existed.
Okay. Great. What's on Gunther?
Pat, I lived in a big old house, and we could tell how fast the wind was blowing by the pitch of the wind blowing through the window.
Pat, thank you for your testimony, and Don and Colleen as well.
Thank you.
Pam, are you next?
Yeah. Obviously, Mr. Chair and members, we're aware of the problem. You're hearing about that problem firsthand today. We know we're dealing with skyrocketing bills. We are also dealing with scarce resources and the negative consequences that result from the combination. You do have a handout from us today that looks like this, and the first couple of pages provide just a brief snapshot of the problem and those consequences. And a little background, and then I want to talk about the remainder of that packet, along with Mr. Elwood, some of the proposed solutions that we think are worthy of discussion here today. According to the U.S. House Minority Staff Report, natural gas heating costs are expected to rise 152% over 4 years ago. These numbers, again, are on the first pages of your handout. At CenterPoint Energy, an average annual residential bill, not just winter heating costs, but cooking and water heating, was $658 in 2002. As of September 30th, 2005, an average annual residential bill was $1,021, a 55% increase even before this winter's price increases. A grant from the Federal Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, will only cover 24% of those costs, despite the fact that the grant will be $100 greater this year. And that's the good news. For the 70% of the income-eligible population who does not receive LIHEAP, or for those just over the income guidelines, the consequences may be far worse. Applications for LIHEAP assistance in Minnesota are up 28% this year, but denials for assistance are up 81%. Most of those are people who are over the state's income standard of 50% of state median. Even if we wanted to reach only half of the income-eligible population, and even if we could ensure that the projected 146,000 households that will receive help this year wouldn't have to pay any more out-of-pocket than they did last year, we'd need a pretty staggering amount of money, about $61 million. A state appropriation of this magnitude is, I'm guessing, unlikely. Any additional federal money would certainly help, but there is no guarantee that the current proposal under consideration in Congress for an additional $2 billion will pass. Even though 5.1 has been authorized, 2.1 has been appropriated so far, and there is only one proposal on the table, and that's for an additional $2 billion. So obviously, we need to address this problem in other ways, both in the short and long term, because it seems higher energy prices are going to stay with us. In the packet, again, you'll find descriptions of several proposals for discussion. The first thing we should think we should do is to spend our federal LIHEAP dollars more effectively. We believe the department should pre-purchase a portion of the propane used by low-income households that receive energy assistance. Like most individuals that heat with propane, the fuel can be purchased ahead in the summer months when the prices are low. In this way, you get more fuel for your money. Energy assistance grants, aggregated for a vendor's low-income customers, can do the same thing. The department has argued in the past that it's too risky to purchase fuel when that price might come down in the winter months. I've never seen that happen, and even if it did, the first couple of years we did this program, we could establish it as a shared savings mechanism so that we could hold households harmless in the event that the price did go down in the winter. But the best argument for knowing that we can do a pre-purchase program is that we've already done it. Three different years, once through a state contract with our organization, and 2 years with the department itself. It worked. Vendors got upfront large payments from the state within 10 days of a negotiated purchase price, and low-income customers' LIHEAP grants bought more fuel. Secondly, we believe we need to anticipate the potential explosion of utility service disconnections at the end of the cold weather period. You heard folks today talk about making payments in the winter only to face huge and probably significantly increased past due bills this spring. When customers can't keep up with utility bills, the traditional utility response is to disconnect their service. Unfortunately, that response only disconnects customers from the utility's revenue stream altogether, when most low-income customers would rather pay a regular amount that they could more easily afford. As utility ratepayers and as policymakers, I think we have a choice. We can pay for the increase in utility bill debt and write-offs, $5 million in 2002 for CenterPoint, but over $9 million as of September 30th, 2005. Or we can pay for a much less expensive program that encourages customers to pay by matching their payments and allowing them to get caught up for the next winter. If we don't, many will remain disconnected in the fall and winter months, or the utilities will have to reconnect them in the fall without collecting any payments from them all spring and summer. Over the same period of time that CenterPoint's bad debt grew from $5 to $9 million, that is 2002 to September 30th of 2005, LIHEAP customer involuntary service disconnections rose 66%, and non-low-income residential disconnections rose 57%. This is part of the problem that the Power On program is meant to address, and it is. And Power On is the model for what we're calling this arrearage management program that I'm explaining now and that we have included in your packet. And importantly, these are not just low-income energy advocate ideas. According to eSource, a company whose membership includes over 350 energy companies, quote, "The importance of communicating with and assisting financially strapped customers rather than just threatening to disconnect them can't be overstated. One of eSource's recommendations is to motivate customers to make regular payments by enrolling them in an arrearage program or subsidized rate." In addition to arrearage management, we think we need to track the effect of higher energy bills on customers' ability to pay. To do so would inform better strategies for dealing with this problem and would limit the financial impact of that problem on other utility ratepayers. For this reason, we are also proposing additional utility reporting about customers who remain disconnected entering the heating season, how many are past due, how many are getting disconnected and reconnected during the non-winter months, and what's happening to that level of utility write-offs. We ask this too because we are seeing more customers that remain shut off during the winter. For example, in November of this year, more than a month after the official start of the cold weather rule, 132 CenterPoint customer service were restored under a reconnection plan. In other words, these customers remained shut off after October 15th and were only reconnected sometime before November 30th. In that same month, Aquila restored 295 customer service under a reconnection plan. From October 15th to October 31st last year, again, it's important to keep in mind, the cold weather rule begins October 15th, Aquila restored 459 customers to service. Just last week, CenterPoint reported that over 600 accounts remained disconnected and that 6 customers were reconnected to service in that same week. We need this kind of information on a monthly basis throughout the year, not just during the cold weather months, which is currently what the utilities file with the Public Utilities Commission. We need it not just to ask how we can better respond, but to even judge whether or not our current cold weather rule is working. There are other proposals in your packet, some of which Mr. Elwood is going to address. So that's it for me, and I'd be happy to answer questions if you have them.
Questions, members? Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. Question I have is what is the income level at which you get to have subsidized energy? I never did know that, and I have the program in my committee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, for just to take a household of 3, it varies by household size. The maximum annual income to be eligible for a LIHEAP grant and also therefore eligible for the Power On program or SIP or anything else is $32,224 a year.
Presenter,
if I have the right year.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That means the legislator will qualify, yes.
If that's your only income and you have 3 people, yes.
Yes, Councilor Dodd.
Oh.
Any questions?
Chairman, how many people in the family?
3.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I thought you were pointing to Bob. just to make it,
Mr. Elwood.
Just Ron Elwood, Legal Services Advocacy Project. The eligibility guideline is 50% of state median, and that varies with the numbers. The actual numbers obviously vary with family size, but just to give you the eligibility criteria, 50% of state median.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, I'd also just like to add to that that the federal statute allows 60% of state median, and so when we're talking about those folks who may be just over income, who are getting denied for an energy assistance grant, but whose income is only that much higher than somebody who would get it, we could raise that income eligibility and in accordance with the federal statute, but again, every time we do things like that, the resource gap gets wider.
Don't have enough money for what we have.
Any other questions? Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. It's nice to see you all again. I have 3 quick points to make. The first one is I think we really need to do something in the area of delivered fuels. As we all know, the cold weather rule is out there protecting folks on the regulated side, but there really isn't anything out there on the delivered fuel side. Pam talked about the pre-buy program. That would be something that the state would need to do. But we're looking to work with the vendors and the state. In fact, I should mention and give credit to Deputy Commissioner Garvey, who's also been working with the groups to try to maybe get something going here. But just a couple of ideas out there. Getting people on a budget plan, that makes sense, I think, and that's something that we ought to think about seriously doing. And the second thing that I think is really important is creating a system whereby if people are kind of fall behind after the cold weather, the heating season, we should set something up so that they can get themselves caught up, a payment kind of plan, before the next winter. So set something up along those lines, and we are, as I say, working with the vendors, and hopefully we can come back to you with something that we all agree to. The second thing I'd like to just talk about is just to compliment what Pam had talked about with regard to this kind of way to deal with arrears for the regulators. We need to break the syndrome. We can't keep going on where people get the protection during the cold weather, and then they fall behind, and then they get shut off, and then they come back next winter, that doesn't do anybody any good. We really need to think of a new way to deal with this, and this is the perfect opportunity to do so. And the ideas that Pam was talking about, I'd just like to step back and say, here's what our goals are. Our goals are to maximize utility revenues by getting people to pay on a regular basis, setting them up on a long-term payment plan. Maximize utility revenues, minimize utility costs, because then they don't have to go shutting people off, turn them back on, send them notices, et cetera, and simply keeping people connected to the system. So from our view, conceptually, that's a win-win-win situation. It's been done in other states, and we'd really like to work with folks to try to set something up and change the paradigm and break the syndrome. The third thing I just want to talk about a little bit is money. I know that's difficult to talk about, but I do have a couple of handouts, if somebody could help me. One is I just want to point out what other states have been doing around the country with respect to these energy costs. And I also have the Pioneer Press editorial that talked about some of the problems and some of the statistics on where we're at. So very, very briefly, just to let you know, states around the country at this point, as of today, have appropriated about $160 million out of general fund money to help people with their bills. 450 in total, $450 million total, $160 million general fund. $100 million of that money is from public benefit money or universal service programs. These are ratepayer-funded programs. They're able to shift dollars from existing programs to focus on the need that we have now. We can't do that because we don't have those kind of programs. But the fact of the matter is that folks have been stepping up. Now, I think we absolutely have to acknowledge the governor's generosity on the $13 million in TANF. Other states have done that as well. And the $1 million that Xcel has generously given to HeatShare to help out as well. But I think, the gap between the resource and the need, I mean, it's just there. And I think what really needs to be mentioned, the last thing I'm going to say is, that anything that the state does would not be tied to the federal guidelines, which means that you can help not only low-income people, but moderate and middle-income people who are feeling the pinch probably for the first time, many of them, this winter. So whatever you would do would have no strings. You could decide whatever your income guideline would be to get assistance. And we have a bunch of ideas on tax credits and things like that we'll be trying to let you know about. And that's, of course, assuming that the federal government doesn't come across with a boatload of money. Thanks very much for your time and attention. I look forward to working with you all during the session.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Elwood. We look forward to working with you and seeing what you and the groups work out.
Good afternoon, Chairman Westrom and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today about.
Please identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Al Huff.
Okay.
And a member of AARP Minnesota's grassroots elections and advocacy team. And I also represent 650,000 AARP members in Minnesota. Like you, AARP is concerned about the high costs that Minnesotans are paying to heat their homes this winter. Heating costs could be at least 35% higher than last year. An increase that is impossible to absorb for those of us who are on fixed incomes. We are especially concerned for our elderly friends and neighbors who are already struggling to pay for day-to-day expenses like health care, prescription drugs, and even groceries. The Low Income Heating Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, has been a vital safety net for thousands of low and moderate income Minnesotans. In order to educate more Minnesota consumers about this program, AARP is encouraging those who are eligible to sign up. AARP is also dedicated to working with Minnesota Department of Commerce Governor Pawlenty, Energy Sense, Legal Services Advocacy Project, and others on a variety of potential ways to increase enrollment. AARP is working hard in Washington, D.C., urging Congress to fully fund the LIHEAP program of $5.1 billion. We're pleased that Governor Pawlenty announced that he is allocating an additional $13 million for heating assistance. We believe additional revenues may still be needed before winter's end. Two, we believe the special attention must be paid to those Minnesotans, primarily in greater Minnesota, that use propane or fuel oil for heating. These consumers are particularly vulnerable because they do not have the protection of the cold weather shutoff rule. We urge our committee to adopt the provisions for protecting delivered fuel customers that the previous speakers mentioned. We strongly support and encourage legislative initiatives that protect delivered fuel customers and implementing pre-buy and arrearage management programs. AARP commends you for having this hearing today and urges you to move forward in a bipartisan manner in implementing the various methods to alert many low and moderate income Minnesotans to keep the heat on this winter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoff. Any questions? Appreciate it. Thank you. And next, Bill Grant and Keith
Butcher.
I understand you're together. Oh, yeah. And then after this, those of you, someone on the utilities side, you'll be next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League. I have with me today Keith Butcher from the Center for Energy and the Environment, and I'm actually going to let Keith do most of the talking. But in keeping with the theme already established this afternoon about the unusually high energy costs that we're experiencing right now, I want to remind the committee about previous testimony over the last several years before your committee, Mr. Chairman, that has demonstrated the value of energy conservation, energy efficiency to both save consumers money and to reduce harmful air emissions that we otherwise put up smokestacks and our individual chimneys. We think, Mr. Chairman, in spite of the short session this year, that this committee should take another look to make sure that we're doing everything possible to maximize the use of the conservation dollars we've already appropriated and to see whether there are additional efforts that may be necessary. We do have a couple of suggestions that we're still working on that we would like the committee to consider in this arena, and this afternoon we just want to give a little bit of background on where we stand both with respect to natural gas prices as well as to electricity prices and the role that energy efficiency, energy conservation might play in helping us manage those costs. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would turn things over to Mr. Butcher.
Thank you. Mr. Butcher, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Keith Butcher. I represent the Center for Energy and Environment. CEE is a technical nonprofit based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we primarily have an expertise in focusing on energy policy issues. Of particular interest is in how that affects energy efficiency initiatives, building science activities, indoor air quality, other environmental issues. We have taken the position and have advocated for years that energy efficiency is a key strategy for us to meet our energy policy needs. As we try to address our future needs for the state, we think it's important to not only consider supply-side management activities that the utilities do, but also look at how that demand factors into it, because economics is always that balance of supply and demand. I do have a handout if I could pass around. I'm not going to go through it in detail, but it just gives some background information on things that I think everybody is all aware of, that natural gas prices have been increasing. Thank you. Just a summary of kind of where our electricity is coming from, just to give an idea to people on the fuel selections that we have used over the years and how that impacts our economics and our environment. as well as comparing that to the economic growth of the state. We do believe that energy efficiency plays a key role, not only from an environmental standpoint, because we're avoiding environmental impacts, but also from an economic standpoint. Energy efficiency is one of the cheapest alternatives there are out there, and by promoting that and helping our businesses become more energy efficient, we therefore help our businesses become more competitive in the marketplace. Well, you've heard a lot about SIP. I do want to just take a second to point out that the whole basis for the Conservation Improvement Program is to increase the focus on those demand-side activities to promote energy efficiency. The original statute, I think, was very ingenious in how it addressed it, in that it allocates a percentage of the utility's gross operating revenues towards demand-side management activities. For gas utilities, as an example, the statute requires that they spend 0.5% of the gross operating revenues. That means the other 99.5% of their revenues can be spent on supply-side activities and other business involvement. But we're talking about a pretty minor amount of money in the scale of things. As prices have increased, the utilities' revenues have increased, which has resulted in a increase in SIP expenditures, but I think it's important to keep in mind it's a very small expenditure on the utilities, from the utilities' perspective. We are taking out a couple ideas on looking at SIP that we will talk about in more detail as we get closer to session, but just to kind of let you know some of the things we're kicking around is ideas of how to encourage more SIP, how to capture more of that energy efficiency. As energy prices increase, it becomes more and more important. Some different examples might include actually setting statewide goals for energy savings, both on the electric and the natural gas side. There are discussions taking place here and around the country in terms of decoupling utility rate recovery so that their incentives are based off of other metrics rather than just purely their sales. And as was mentioned earlier, there is, with the new energy legislation that was passed on the federal level, tax incentives available. If we could tap into those, perhaps matching that with state tax incentives, or at least working with the regulatory departments such as the Department of Commerce and utilities to find out best ways to leverage those activities. We believe that overall, energy efficiency is a vital part of meeting our energy needs going into the future, and we should continue to maintain a focus and try to be innovative and capture more and more energy savings that benefit both our citizens and our businesses. That's all I have for comments. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Butcher. Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you. We'll certainly look forward to working with you. Okay. Next, Jeff Doherty from CenterPoint, and then members from Xcel Energy will be next, and then after that, Mike Franklin, just so you know the order, from the Chamber of Commerce. So, Jeff, welcome to our committee.
Thank you,
Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is Jeff Dockery. I'm the Director of Regulatory Services for CenterPoint Energy's Minnesota Gas Operations. Just as a summary, CenterPoint Energy serves approximately 770,000 customers in the state of Minnesota, and approximately 240,000 of Minnesota communities. It is my understanding that the committee would like to hear 2 points today, and I'll address those fairly briefly, quickly. The one topic is just an update on energy prices for this heating season, and the second is just a brief review of our conservation program efforts. Our original forecast for natural gas prices back in September was that consumers should expect to pay approximately 40% more annually this year than they did the previous year. Because of the warm weather this year, wholesale prices have come down recently, and rates have been lower than we predicted. November was 12% warmer than normal. December was approximately normal in weather, and January is going to be approximately 25% warmer than normal. Mm-hmm. And that is not only here in Minnesota, but that is also across the certain parts of the country, particularly the Northeast and everything. And so the impact of that is to lower the natural gas prices from where we were anticipating they would be at this time. We were anticipating gas prices somewhere in the $11 range, and they today we're looking more in the $9 type of a range for natural gas prices. What does this mean? I'll give you an example for January. Back in September, we would have expected that the average residential customer would pay somewhere between $250 and $260 in January for their natural gas bill. This year, we would expect the average customer to pay right around $190, with the lower weather and the lower with the warmer weather and the lower prices. Excuse me, that was last year they paid $190. I'll get it right yet. Last year they paid $190. This year we're expecting them to pay between $195 and $205. So while it's been warmer than normal, prices are still up a little bit, but the consumer's bill should be just slightly higher than it was last year at this time. We still are encouraging customers to conserve and use our product wisely to weatherize their homes and to sign up for budget plans to help themselves out for the long run. I'll touch on consumer efforts just for a minute because I thought the industry and the regulatory bodies this year did a particularly good job in communicating to the public. We started our communication efforts in July. The Public Utilities Commission, the Department of Commerce, I think all the major energy providers got the message out, the news media covered it, and I think that was potentially was very helpful for this this heating season. I'll switch briefly now to conservation improvement programs. Our policy at CenterPoint Energy is to offer balanced, cost-effective conservation. So I'd like to do three things. I'll just touch on the history of our conservation programs, talk about briefly what we're currently doing with conservation, and then address is there anything more that we can do. Conservation energy programs in Minnesota were established or enacted back in 1992. Since that time, CenterPoint Energy has spent over $77 million on conservation programs. We've realized an excess of 8.2 BCF in natural gas savings. What that, in essence, that means is that's equivalent energy savings for 82,000 residential homes. We've had approximately 35% of our customer base participate in our energy conservation programs. We're recognized nationally by the American Council of Energy Efficient Economies and received 3 awards from them for conservation programs. And generally speaking, when I'm about the country, I do hear quite frequently how Minnesota is a leader in conservation programs. Not just CenterPoint Energy, but the other utilities in the state also are recognized as a leader in conservation programs. And I think that shines well on the policymakers in this state as well as the utilities in the state. Our current conservation program, our current budget is approximately $7 million. That money is split approximately 50-50 as far as expenditures to residential customers and to business customers. However, the bulk of our energy savings of our conservation programs come from our commercial customers. They have production types of energy savings that we can go out and tap into, help to show them how to use our product more efficiently, and they generate much more savings for us. And annually, we have approximately 24,000 participants in our conservation program. This year, we will be spending approximately $7.8 million in conservation program. We will save in excess of 1.3 BCF of gas. And we have participants. Yeah, 48,000 participants in our program this year. Anything more that we can do on conservation? I think that there's always room for improvement in conservation programs. That said, this year we worked with the Department of Commerce, and particularly we're looking at customers who are most vulnerable in our society and see if there are things we can do to help them with conservation. We had an acceleration program this year where we distributed approximately 23,000 3M window insulator kits to low-income customers that received energy assistance in the 2004-2005 heating season, saving these customers approximately 20% of their heating load. We also modified our low-income weatherization to include furnace and boiler replacements. This year, we were estimating that we will replace approximately 300 furnaces. That's up from 60 that we had the previous under of the program before it was modified. We also do approximately 300 tune-ups for low-income customers. Our program didn't have that particular feature in the past. For schools, we're providing approximately 180 rebates for free boiler tune-ups to 89 schools in December 2005. And this request from schools is continuing to escalate, which is a good thing. We want them to take advantage of this program. So we also have 42 K-12 customers attend an educational seminar on conservation. There's a lot of interest in conservation with our schools, and I think it's important that we hook up with them and help them out. So with that, that ends my testimony. I'm available to answer questions.
So question I have on the schools, what is it they actually do for the schools? Just something that generates more efficiency, or is it just a tune-up?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, I think it does. The tune-ups do generate more efficiency for the school going in, and so when their budgets are constrained, when we can offer them to pay for their tune-ups in its entirety, and it's not a budget item for it, I think it encourages them to actually take action for us to come and help tune up their boilers.
Mm-hmm. So, questions, and other members might have questions. Just what are you seeing this year? Are you just higher than normal, or the demand on SIP programs, insulators, kits, etc., is that higher too?
Mr. Chair, I think that the interest in conservation is much higher this year, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has to go back to the messages that were delivered starting last fall and early last winter, for customers to be aware of the potential for the higher energy bills, and we saw people respond to that, and that's a good thing. As far as our arrearages, we are seeing our arrearages up this year. They're up approximately 3.5% from where they were last year. On the other hand, our system is also continuing to grow about 2% a year, so our arrearages are up. The number of people in arrears are up, but it's not. We're up about 1.5-2%, I think, net.
Hmm. Any other questions, Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Chair Western, and congratulations on your twins.
Thank you.
That was exciting to hear about. Mr. Dougherty, have you done a cost-benefit analysis of the $77 million that you've spent since 1992 when the conservation programs began? So you know how this has benefited both you and the consumer and the industry?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we have. The state of Minnesota, the Department of Commerce, has a very rigorous cost-benefit test model that is used. And most all of these programs have to pass those cost-benefit tests. There are some that we've all decided for societal reasons do not need to pass the societal test type of thing. Those are for the low-income types of customer groups.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of these programs have passed those tests.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Doherty, a question I get once in a while from constituents is, does your organization offer rebates for personal home furnace updates, efficiency, buying better efficient furnaces, things like that? I thought I understood you didn't. Is there a reason that program maybe isn't as efficient as other things?
Mr. Chair, we do offer high-efficiency furnace rebates. In matter of fact, if my notes are correct here, that we've done almost over 10,000 of them this year for high-efficiency furnace rebates. So
the homeowner is replacing the old furnace?
That's correct.
Okay. What is that rebate? What do you offer them?
Just a second. Let me check with Mr. Chair. I should have introduced Ms. Angie Kleins with me today. She's the manager of our conservation program, and I'll let her answer that question.
Okay.
Angie, just identify yourself for the record, please.
Angie Klein with CenterPoint Energy, Minnesota Gas. Chair, in answer to your question, CenterPoint Energy provides a $100 rebate if a customer installs a 92% efficient furnace, and we offer a $150 rebate if a customer installs a 94% or higher efficient furnace. We also have a $100 rebate for an 85% or greater efficiency boiler for residential, and then we also have a rebate for an integrated, which was like a boiler, $150 on that also. So, and we did provide close to 11,000 rebates in the calendar year 2005.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Otherwise, we'll call the next testifiers. Thank you.
Deb Sundin at Apple. Deb Sundin at Apple.
Pat and Deb from Excel.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Pat Bolin, Excel Energy. I manage low-income programs for our northern five states. I just wanted to take a brief moment and acknowledge Mr. Eloff's work. You never know when he might be Mr. Eloff doing business as Excel Energy. So I need to make sure we get that covered before we move on.
You don't want him to leverage a buyout?
Never know. Again, thank you. You've heard a lot of discussion today around low-income programs, and the programs that I specifically manage is around the LIHEAP, the cold weather rule, the Power On program that we administer in conjunction with Energy Sense Coalition. And it was really all of a result of a lot of work by a lot of people over the last several years, whether it was based on the energy prices or as we came before your committee in the last couple of years and changes to the cold weather rule or the development of the Power On language in statute. We're very excited about where we have been as a company relative to low-income programs. We're excited also about the future, working with the entities, specifically Energy Sense Coalition, Legal Services Advocacy Project. We have worked extensively with the Department of Commerce, with the LIHEAP program, and I sit on a policy advisory board that's directed by Commissioner Garvey that has worked very well. But in short, it is a conglomeration or a collaboration of a lot of people that we work with in trying to address a lot of these issues relative to low-income households. There has been some discussion in many fronts as far as what's going to happen as we come off of the cold weather rule April 15th. I can assure you that at that time, we're not going to be sending out masses of forces to go out and disconnect people's services at that time. That really is the beginning of a new communication process with our customers. Yes, the protection does end on April 15th. However, customers that are past due at that time would go through the billing process and be sent a disconnect notice or a past due notice, again, with the opportunity for them to contact us and work out some payment arrangements that, yes, in essence, can take over a significant period of time. And we do look at the budget helper in order to help us do that. We can take arrears that may exist at that point and spread them out over a 12-month period, with the intent of keeping people connected. And we work very hard to do that. And on an annual basis, about 97.2% of our customers on average stay connected. So 2.7% or 2.8% of our customers may get disconnected in a given year. But again, that is not the first option that we're going to pursue or have pursued in the past. We look forward again to working with those entities and look forward to working with this committee should there be any additional legislation that may come up this session. But I'm very welcome to take any questions, or I can turn it over to Deb Sundin to talk about our SIP programs.
Why don't we have Deb talk, and then if there's any questions, we can cover them at the end. Deb, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Deb Sundin, or Deborah Sundin is my official name, and I'm the Director of SIP Product Marketing for Excel Energy. And, Chair, I do have a handout.
I think that's Anna can take. Okay, I'm
there. Thank you. I just thought I would briefly review some of our SIP activities and our results. What I'm handing out for all of you to see and look at after this meeting, if you'd like to, is a little bit of history of what we have spent and the achievements we've made on both the electric side as well as the gas side since 2003, and put together our goals, our approved goals and budgets for 2006 through the Department of Commerce. And if you can see from the first page in electric conservation, and I'm going to give you some 2005 numbers. I do have one caveat. We have not submitted these to the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission for review and approval yet. So these are kind of numbers we are going to be submitting in our report on April 1st. But we have spent in 2005 on our electric side, which is our biggest SIP efforts. We have spent $42.5 million in 2005 on those electric efforts, and we have a minimum spending requirement of just under $36 million. So we overspent our requirement by about 18%. We were able to generate through that money just under 260 gigawatt hours of energy saved in 2005. If you take a look at the next page, it covers the natural gas efforts that we've had. We spent $4.6 million in 2005 out of a minimum spending requirement of $3 million. So we spent about $1.6 million over our minimum spending requirement, which is about 55%. Of that, we were able to achieve $1,163,000 MCF. A lot of that, about a good portion of that comes from, I should say about 400,000 of that comes from one project, however. And that's why when you compare across and you see our achievements in 2003, 2004, and our goals for 2006, that seems awfully high, but it is from a very specific large industrial project that we completed this year. I also brought in, I'm not going to go through them, but the next couple of pages does list all of our SIP conservation programs on the business side, electric and gas. It also has a listing of all our residential and low-income programs, electric and gas. I wanted to mention briefly, and it has been mentioned already today, that we have been working with the Department of Commerce to do an accelerated gas SIP plan for 2006. It was approved, the Xcel Energy Plan was approved January 19th. And we are busy trying to implement that plan as we speak. We have committed to an extra spending in 2006 over budget, approved budget of $1 million. We have divided that spending into the four segments of low income, residential, small business, and commercial and industrial so that we can help all our customers across all our classes. The low income portion that we've included in this $1 million includes weatherization kits to all our gas low-income SIP program participants. We are going to be doubling our emergency furnace replacements for 2006 from 50 to 100, and we're going to provide for 30 water heater replacements with these dollars. On the residential side, we're going to do some targeted consumer education to natural gas, our part of our natural gas service territory that has both a high incidence of low-income customers as well as older homes. We're increasing our rebates for heating system furnaces by $25 for 2006, and we are also actually providing a rebate. We don't normally do hot water heater rebates, and we are going to provide a small hot water heater rebate for efficiency if they also replace their furnace. We're increasing our rebate similarly for the boiler systems on the residential side, and reducing from $35 to $25 the price of a home energy audit. We've also added a program on insulation and sealing of attic bypasses. In the small business and in the commercial, we are providing a 25% bonus rebate on new boiler system installations, and then we are offering a promotion providing 80% of the cost for boiler tune-ups targeted at schools, nursing homes, hospitals, and public buildings. And we're doing similar measures on our commercial industrial side as well, which are our large customers. And with that, I can take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sundin, I have two questions. I'm sure that we all take time to read those nice colored brochures that you put in our bills, letting us know about the conservation and any of the upgrades that you guys are doing. But I'm interested. You have education a couple times in your report that you're giving us. What other means are you utilizing to educate consumers, especially low-income individuals?
Well, for low-income specifically, what we have in our low-income program, we work with the CAF agencies, and Pam Marshall was up here earlier. We work with Energy Sensor, one of our agencies, and they offer a program that we pay through SIP for them, where they actually, they take the customers that come through their office, and we give them lists of energy assistance type lists that qualify. And they go out and do an educational audit of those homes, providing them both. They take a look and see what measures can be done, weatherization, insulation, appliance replacement. But they also do a behavioral educational audit of those homes for those homeowners. For other residential customers, we have many ways they can come through and get education. We have an incredible amount of energy efficiency education on our website. We have both an e-source library as well as tips of our own out there. You can request from us, and this is what we'll be sending out to targeted neighborhoods. It's called 60 Ways to Save, in which they are very simple and common sense things you should look at in your house and save, and how to save on your energy costs in your home. We will send that out. As well as in our bill inserts, our energy update newsletter, we also provide, every time we send that out, we provide tips to our customers, and then we also have the programs they can participate in.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Just one more question. I'm just curious, is it Excel the business or Excel the foundation that has that wonderful commercial out that gave the $1 million to Salvation Army?
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, that's through our foundation.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, can someone just tell me what 60 gigawatts, what does that mean in terms of total percentage? What kind of savings is that? Put that in context. I don't know what that means.
It's about over a half a percent of our sales in 1 year.
Oh. Of your system.
Of our system.
And what about the electrical or the natural gas side?
The natural gas is well over a percent this year because we did so well.
Okay, thank you.
So, same question for you. What do you offer rebates for homeowners replacing their heating sources, and what's your program offer?
Yes, we do. We do offer a furnace rebate and boiler rebate for the residential customers. On a current basis, it is $75 for the 92% efficiency and $100 for the 94% efficiency. However, we are adding $25 to both those amounts through this accelerated gas plan for 2006.
Okay.
We didn't hand this thing.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sundin, I was wondering on the accelerated plan, it mentions nursing homes, and just if you could elaborate, is there a lot of participation there? Have you worked with a number of nursing homes, or is it more of the schools that have been participating?
Actually, of that list, the schools, the nursing homes, the hospitals, they're all high participants and have historically been high participants in our SIP programs. They're usually owner-occupied type firms or very easy to actually do the financial sell on energy efficiency, and their bills, having to pay their energy bills, goes right to their bottom line, so to the extent that they can alleviate that, it helps them out. This particular promotion where we're going to be paying 80% of the tune-up cost, at any one time our normal program pays 25%, so they could come to us in any given year and get a tune-up, and we would give them a rebate for that. This year we have raised it to 80%, and that was actually a request of Commissioner Garvey and the Department of Commerce that we target those customer groups.
Thank you, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either one of you. Of the month, I think you mentioned 2.5% of the people choose to be cut off. Does that represent the amount of bills incoming revenue that you get, you deem as non-collectible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, no, the 2.7, I want to be careful, they don't choose to be disconnected. It flows through a process that they ultimately do get disconnected. That can range for any number of reasons, but typically if a customer gets disconnected, they're usually 60 days or more in arrears. 60 days or more in arrears could vary across the board, whether they're electric customer, electric and gas customer, or homeowner or apartment dweller. So it could be any combination of things. But no, it's not necessarily representative of 2.7% of our revenue.
Is that the amount that you do not collect because it's deemed non-collectible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, in 2005 in the state of Minnesota, it was about $12.5 million that was listed as debt that we were not going to recover. And just to clarify that, we did see a significant spike in those uncollectible write-offs the fourth quarter of 2005, particularly related to the change in the federal bankruptcy rules. A lot of people rushed to file before the end of, or before the October deadline.
So to follow up on that, are your arrearages higher than average, than normal right now, given higher costs, if you will?
And Mr. Chair, our arrears are increased over last year. There's a couple of key components to that. First and foremost was we had converted to a new billing system in 2005, which did delay by several months our collection activity. We wanted to make sure we went through the appropriate conversion process and verified things were working correctly. So that did put us behind, and that did increase arrears during the summer months of last year. We also have seen a little bit of an increase due to the natural gas prices, but certainly as Mr. Dougherty referred to from CenterPoint, is not as high as that we would have expected it to be at this particular time of the year.
Okay. Representative Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just follow up on that, too. And I should probably know the answer to this, but that $12.5 million, what do you do? Can you pass that on to customers through the rate process, or is that a loss to your shareholders? Or
Mr. Chair, $12.5 million.
Did you say they were non-collectibles or $12.5
million? Oh, correct. Yes. That does become eventually part of a rate case in the state of Minnesota, so we would need to charge those as an operating expense going forward. One of the things that obviously as a company, for many reasons, we try and minimize what your bad debt would be. But especially in 2005, with the change in the bankruptcy rules, there was an acceleration of those claims.
But, Mr. Chair, eventually that comes back to you, in a sense, because you can charge that out to the customers.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. A portion of it or all of it, depending on the rate-making process at the commission.
Thank you. Next, we've got Mike Franklin. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mike Franklin. I manage energy policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We represent 2,600 businesses across the state, and you've heard a lot about energy costs this afternoon, and if you'll bear with me, you're going to hear just a little bit more. Energy, particularly this year, electric energy is a big issue for our members and for business in Minnesota, and it's getting bigger. We've confirmed through our policy development process that, once again, reliability is the kind of chief concern of our members across the state, but cost of electricity is increasing on the list of priorities for our member companies, and just most recently, there's a few ways in which we've confirmed this, but most recently, our Grow Minnesota annual report came out, and it contains, I believe you've all gotten copies of that, but it contains a chart on the community cost of doing business. I don't think you have it today, but it's somewhere in your office, I'm sure. Energy costs have taken a place right alongside of housing, labor, and land costs as areas in which to improve, and that's a significant jump. it's sort of what we refer to energy that is as an emerging issue and one on a very short list of issues that may not be in the sort of top tier of issues that our members are concerned about, but is moving in that direction. This is not a metro problem. It's something that we're seeing all across the state. And just to very briefly go through a few instances where we're actively participating or monitoring. As you know, Xcel Energy has requested a $168 million rate increase. That would mean a 6 to 11% increase on customers depending on their energy profile. The Metro Emissions Reduction Project, MERP, bill has come due, and we have estimated the effect as about a $5,000 impact on an average grocery store, $28,000 for a mid-sized manufacturer, and $400,000 to a large industrial. If I said $5 million, I meant $5,000. Did I say 5,000? Okay, good.
It's just that he's a grocer.
It's early in the year. And that's on all Xcel customers, metro area, the St. Cloud, Winona, and other places across Minnesota. Other utilities are seeking rate increases. The SMPA, Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency Board, has voted twice in the past for 3.5 months to increase their wholesale rates, which will affect 18 city-owned municipal utilities, primarily in southern Minnesota. Dairyland Power has recently voted to increase its wholesale rates as well. Both of those utilities cite fuel costs, purchase power costs as a result of the new MISO Day 2 market and other purchase power concerns. And also, getting to infrastructure, Minnesota Power has also filed a docket with the Public Utilities Commission to recover $58 million to invest in some emissions reduction programs up there. Speaking of infrastructure, you know, the Chamber supported the energy bill last session that created hopefully will make it easier for utilities to invest in new transmission lines. As I mentioned, reliability is the chief concern of our members, and while we hope those things will get built and we expect to see a lot of certificates of need for new transmission lines this year, we recognize that there's a cost associated with that, and we want to keep that in mind as well. And then we have the sort of looming specter of what to do about the significant baseload gap that the CapEx group and others have projected that will start affecting Minnesota customers sometime in the next 5 to 10 years. We also, you know, we will support closing that gap through a mix of conservation and new infrastructure, but we also recognize those things come with a cost as well. So very briefly, 2006 has already started out to be a more expensive year for Minnesota business customers and all customers, as you've heard. The rise in prices is having an effect on competitiveness in Minnesota. Might be too early to determine just how much of an impact, but we know that it is because our members have told us. And we, you know, keeping this in perspective, you know, in Minnesota, we do have relatively competitive electric prices across the state, and our function here is to basically to make sure we don't jeopardize that. So that's a brief overview of what we've been up to. I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Mr. Franklin, on these rate cases, the different entities are doing, are you guys commenting on them and raising concerns?
Yeah, the Mr. Chair, the answer shortly is yes. We are a party in the Xcel rate case representing business customers. We're just in the beginning of that process. It's the only rate case that's active before the Public Utilities Commission, but we're also monitoring and in various stages of involvement with other dockets that will have an impact on customers. And with respect to the utilities that fall outside the PUC's jurisdiction, our role is primarily one of information. We've been trying to communicate to local chambers to make sure they understand the reasons for the rate increases and ask the right questions when it comes before their municipal utilities.
Okay. Representative Paya.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Franklin, when MERP was being debated in 2003, it was estimated that the total cost impact was going to be about $1 billion. What did that end up being?
Franklin. Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, I don't have that number in front of me, but I have heard it's significantly, it's more than $1 billion. I would have to go back and check, but I believe the cost has escalated a bit.
Anybody in the audience know where that's coming in right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell,
please follow up with us on that.
Please do, Mr. Franklin. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Representative Hans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franklin, last week I attended the Chamber's environmental event at the Science Museum, and the keynoter talked about rate and reliability, but also mentioned that there was a third piece when there were customer surveys, and that was environmental concerns, and that in the last 15 years there had been a change in that actually concerns from ratepayers were greater for environmental concerns than on rate and reliability. Do you? I think I saw you there, and can you just elaborate on that? I don't have those figures in front of me.
Sure. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe just to clarify, that was not our event. We were President David Olson and our board chair, Joe Swedberg, appeared on a panel at the Minnesota Environmental Initiative breakfast last week, and I believe, if memory serves, you're referring to the Great River Energy CEO's discussion of what was important to their members, and that's exactly right. And we share the commitment of reliable, low-cost, and environmentally superior technologies, and we continue to support the growth of the renewable industry in Minnesota as much as that is associated, as long as we can protect customers from the downside risks of additional mandates. But actually, I've got a file on my desk that's kind of continued to get bigger throughout the last year. I started it after last session of all of the new renewable projects that are kind of springing up from all across the state, and it's getting to be a pretty sizable file and a pretty good indicator that we have a success story happening in Minnesota as it relates to renewables.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. And we're going to now move into some telecom issues. Representative Beard, hold off on Representative Beard. Mr. Ruloff, we'd like a quick update on the wireless issue. If you'd want to give us just an update on the court case. And for the energy issues that we were just discussing here, part of the reason of this hearing was to kind of get the juices flowing again. We've got sessions starting March 1st. But if there are bills that people in the audience or members are working on, please be advised to be moving on them soon, find authors so they can be ready to be introduced the first week, the first day, hopefully, because we're not going to have a lot of committee time to work on this, and so they need to be sorted out over the next month, so when we come to session March 1st, we can hit the road running. And so I'm just advising and warning everybody in the audience, some of you talked about provisions you're trying to talk to different groups on. Put an urgency on that if you really want to get some discussion and some bills heard, because we aren't going to be able to wait 2 weeks and then all of a sudden have a bill that's got to be heard, because we aren't going to have that kind of time. So consider yourself forewarned and fairly warned. So, Mr. Ruloff, tell us just kind of a little history of the cell phone bill that we passed and the recent court decision that came out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. In 2004, the House enacted House File 1692 as part of the Omnibus Telecom Act. And as passed by the House, its major provision went as follows. If a cell phone company makes a substantive change in a customer's contract, and a substantive change was defined in a change in the terms or conditions of the contract that would result in an increased charge to the customer. In that case, the customer was given 60 days to opt out of that change in writing and terminate the contract without penalty. If there was no opt-out provision exercised, if the customer did nothing, the contract was considered to be modified and the substantive change would be implemented. In the conference committee, the Senate language prevailed and was somewhat different from that was in the House. In the Senate language, the customer was given 60 days to opt in writing to a substantive change that would become part of the contract. And if the customer did not opt in, the original contract terms were held to apply, and the substantive change was not implemented. This is the version that eventually passed both the House and Senate and was signed into law by the governor. It was quickly thereafter challenged by several cell phone companies and has been in the courts ever since. The companies held that the opt-in provisions and the 60 days to decide on the part of the customer essentially amounted to rate regulation, which is preempted by federal law. The Attorney General, in defending the statute, argued that the statute is only an attempt to regulate the terms and conditions of contracts, which states are expressly granted the authority to do by the Federal Telecommunications Act. Late last year, we had a decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit that sided with the companies on that. So that law is not a law. The Attorney General's office decided not to appeal that decision en banc to the Eighth Circuit, meaning appealing it to a larger number of judges than the three-judge panel that made the decision. But they're still considering whether or not to appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and my understanding is that they have until March 9th to do that.
So, Mr. Rudolph, not to put you on the spot at all, was there any part of that decision if we would have had the House language prevail or things that stick out to you that could have maybe been changed in legislation that could have at least allowed us to deal with the consumer protection issues?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not a lawyer and I don't even play one on TV. It's possible. There's some language from the decision, and I'll quote it. It says this statute effectively voids the terms of contracts and substitutes by statute a different contractual arrangement. The existing contracts exemplify an opt-out structure. Subdivision 3, the provision in question, mandates an opt-in contract structure. So obviously that was something that the court disagreed with, and your statement that maybe if we'd stuck with opt-out, they may have passed it. I don't know.
Well, thank you for the update. And if you do have the occasion to talk to some people in the know on this specific issue, if there's things that they see could be changed, we certainly could look at that. If you have a chance in the next few weeks, you could do that. Any other questions on that issue? Otherwise, we'll present Gunther.
So make sure I'm clear, before the law that we passed, if my cell phone company changed their contract, I could take the advantage of any improvement. In other words, they always say, hurry up and come in, you gain this, this, and this, which is their way of competing with the other company that already gave somebody that. Now, the only way I can change anything, you know, before it was done automatically with the way we passed law, now I have to go up there and sign up again in order to get the benefits that we would have gotten automatically if our law was deemed okay by the court. Is that correct?
Mr. I think I followed Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther. I guess I'd say the law was passed by the House. I mean, this was directed at action that was initiated by the companies in changing the contract. And the action, or the language in the House version, allowed customers to opt out if they didn't want to take advantage of that change. The Senate language, which was adopted in conference, required the customer to opt in to that change. And that's what was different.
Thank you, Mr. Rudolph. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair,
why don't we start with...
Okay. I was going to address the current issue.
Go ahead. Sorry, Representative.
And Representative Hoppe was in that mixed master battle with me. That's right. The three of us, but if I remember, the genesis of that bill was not necessarily companies initiating the changes to contracts, but say a client calling and, you know, usually when you sign up for a cell phone, you get a two-year contract. And you're locked in. You can't drop the program or there's onerous penalties. And unwittingly, people were calling in and saying, hey, I want to
I want a fancier cell phone, or I want to change my minute plan. And every time you touch that contract, the new two-year window, it was extended. The new two-year clock started running. And I think that was the genesis of the bill. And we got into the opt-in, opt-out business. It was driven by that motivation. And so I'm wondering if that doesn't shed some light on the discussion here. I don't remember that it was necessarily company-driven benefits that they were offering, although that would certainly fall into the discussion. If a company called and asked me to change my cell phone, and I said, sure. Part of the problem was we didn't know that the two-year meter started running again. And that was where I think the representative who wrote the bill got caught on that when he wanted to terminate his plan and found out that unwittingly he'd had contract extensions put on him that he didn't know about. Now, I'll say that in setting the table for what you're about to say with the Telecom Communications Group, because we may be able to take it up on that basis and craft something that would stand court challenge.
Well, with that, Representative Beard, what I'd like now is to follow up on the hearing we had this fall with overviewing some telecommunication issues. What's evolved since then, I heard from a few members on the committee on some interest in changing some things. What I have approved and asked Representative Boone to do is to take the bill of his that we heard last year, I believe, and laid it on the table for possible inclusion, and work with that as a shell, as a vehicle, as a bill to take up in a working group of three Democrats and three Republicans from this committee to work on not major telecommunication reform, but some reforms that have been talked about and been around. And in fact, in the bill in 2004 was in the Senate bill, didn't pass the House initially, but Representative Beard, I think, not being a supporter of the bill then, at least introduced the bill last year, and has some interest in it, as do other members have it, and perhaps that would be a telecom bill that would have some provisions, a cell phone provision, if that's an issue you want to look at as a working group as well. That would certainly be appropriate, but I would like to have that then ready for early in session, and that's the purpose of the working group, to look at some of these issues. Not a major reform initiative, which at least was a possibility this fall when we were talking about it, but measuring the interest and the interest of the feedback from committee members, this I think hopefully will be a good response to those with the interest, and a good way to get it processed and our committee a better version of a bill to look at right away. So with that, Mr. Representative Brewer, why don't you tell us a little about your bill? We'll have some testimony, pro and con on it, from three different testifiers that have asked to testify. But recognize I do want to be out of here. We set 3:30 as the ending time. We've been here, that'll be just about 3 hours. And so your working group will deal with even more nitty-gritty than what we can deal with here today. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Yes, I'm happy to have this be a vehicle if that's what the committee wishes it to be. So let me talk a little bit about House Bill 1319 and where I'd like to take it. There have been a few of us that have had a meeting or two just to talk about doing something with some sort of a consensus or bipartisan flavor to it, to move not only telecom, but just information services and broadband connectivity ahead. And just to call this a telecom bill, it maybe would be too limiting, I think, in what I have in mind and goes to the heart of part of why I changed my mind, if you will, from that conference committee that we served on a couple of years ago when this was known as Article 4, and we led the charge to pull that out. Because it just didn't set right with us. I think there were a lot of new folks here. That was right after an election with a huge turnover in the House. A lot of us didn't have any history with this discussion and this piece of legislation. It sort of came from the Senate. And we said, you know what, if it's a good idea today, it's going to be a good idea next year, too. So let's pull this out and let it steep a little more. Since then, I've had some different thinking on this, mostly because I've come to see of it not so much as a cable TV bill or even a telecom bill, but this is about connectivity in a worldwide marketplace that we're in. This is no longer the industrial age. This is the age of information. And if you haven't read a book called The Earth is Flat by Thomas Friedman, I'd recommend strongly that you get the book. It may also change your thinking on some of these issues also, to where we're not talking about industries and geography as much anymore as we're just talking about being connected all around the world. And the United States used to lead in this issue. The last few years, we've kind of got fallen behind. Not because we're not moving ahead, we're just not moving ahead as fast as other parts of the world are. And I think they're kind of smoking us right now. This legislation, I think, is a tool in that toolbox to help our companies and our communities compete. In 1973, there was a piece of legislation known as Chapter 238 in the Minnesota Statutes that allowed communities to set up cable commissions, either by themselves or in joint authority with other communities and jurisdictions. And it prescribed, and it was amended, I think, in the 1980s, at the behest of the cable companies to say, you know, if we're here, anybody else who comes in has got to play by exactly the same program we had to play by, which in effect gave the cable companies and the cable commissions pretty much a government monopoly, much like we regulate industries deal with electric, gas, and telephone companies. We gave the cable commission and the cable companies pretty much what amounts to a monopoly situation. However, we deal with telephone, gas, and electric quite a bit differently than we deal with cable companies, in that we mandate all kinds of stuff, like cold weather rules, for instance. We mandate rate cases. We mandate where and how they can build plants and facility, and so on and so forth, that we don't necessarily extract that pound of flesh from the cable company. So it's a little bit different. We give them something that we don't ask of the other regulated industries. So I want you to kind of hold that thought, too, while we're talking about opening the, giving the ability to do other things to the cable commissions that exist around the around our state. I want you to think about that for a moment. This isn't about more TV channels coming to my house from a competitor because I happen to be mad at Time Warner or Comcast or whoever it is. That's not what this is about. This is about things we can't even imagine yet, coming up and down fiber optic cables that will come in over our gas line or a new line pulled through my yard or whatever. And I think that we have, in Chapter 238 as it currently stands, artificial friction in the marketplace. That's a term from that Flat World book. I don't want to call it a barrier. I want to call it unnecessary friction for something else to happen. And I'm not just talking about more cartoon channels. I want to make sure you understand that point clearly. I'll tell you a little story, then I'm going to ask for a testifier to come forward. Back in 1972 or 73, somewhere in there, remember, we used to all get a black telephone from Bell Telephone, and we had to rent that thing for a couple dollars a month, and it had a rotary dial on it. My kids called it.
I don't remember that representative.
You don't remember. You're a little too young for that, huh? I remember buying my first telephone from Ames Department Store. It had push buttons on it. And in the corners, the lower left corner was a star, and the lower right corner was a pound sign. And, of course, I hung that thing on my wall, and I was so excited because I had a push-button phone, and my dad still had a rotary phone. Mine was tan, and his was black. So I picked up the phone, and I pushed zero, and an operator answered, a real voice. And she said, "How can I help you?" And I said, "I have a question about this new phone. What does the star and the pound key mean?" And she said, "Mr. Baird, those keys are there for things that you can't even imagine yet." And that was her answer to me in 1973. And I'm telling you, the same thing applies here. There's stuff going to come down our fiber optic cables that we can't even imagine yet. And probably isn't even in the purview of this community, or this committee. I think this bill, though, does merit our attention because it's going to take friction out of the marketplace that's going to make it possible for a pound and a star key to be available for us, not only through one provider, but through many providers, and some of them happen to be telephone companies. So, knowing that, the original version of House Bill 1319 that you have somewhere in your package, I'm sure you all saved it just because I handed it out to you, there will be eventually a delete-all amendment that's tweaked it a little bit because the Lake of Minnesota cities weighed in, as we'd hoped people would. and the Association of Minnesota Cable Commissioners, whatever their acronym is, they had a few things to say also. And so we've got some cleanup language that will amount to delete all. Once we're actually in session, you can actually vote on this bill. I'll be bringing it back in that form. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to ask if Mr. Jerry Knickerbocker could come up and make a few succinct comments, and then I think there's a few other folks that have something to say about this before we stand for questions.
All right. Mr. Knickerbocker, if you can come forward, identify yourself for the record, but we need to wrap up in about 20 to 25 minutes, so we're not going to debate all the merits here, but if we can try to keep it to about 5-6 minutes, so we stay fair with the three of you.
I'll do that, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jerry Knickerbocker. I'm here this afternoon on behalf of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, which is a trade group of local phone local service providers, some wireless companies, and a number of associated members who are suppliers to the industry. The bill that Representative Beard referenced, has been around for a couple of years. We don't have the bill in front of us, but just to refresh your memory just a little bit, all this bill does is give some flexibilities to municipalities in terms of when and if they decide to offer additional cable franchises. The current law was written a long time ago for a different set of circumstances, and municipalities maintain they have to follow the letter of the law, so that creates some difficulties when you have a competitor that shows up that wants to compete. Because the response they get back oftentimes is, well, we have to follow the letter of the law, we've got to give you the same thing as we have the other guy. Sorry, we'd like to do better for you, but we just can't work something out. Or they choose not to work something out. Long and short of it is, this bill that we had last legislative session does a couple of things. It requires the new competitors to pay the same 5% franchise fee to the city as the incumbent does. The new competitors are required to provide the same PEG requirements. Doesn't affect the existing cable franchises of the existing provider or the cable administrators or the cable commissions. Everyone that's in the business providing service is held harmless. This bill doesn't disrupt the normal relationship between the city and the cable franchisee. This is a permissive piece of legislation. If the city chooses not to use it, they don't use it. Or if the city decides that we're going to impose everything lock, stock, and barrel exactly it was the way it is on the incumbent cable provider, they have that option. So this doesn't mandate anything. This just provides an opportunity for cities to recognize the uniqueness of the circumstances they might find themselves in, invite in a second provider, a competitive provider, and work something out between the two parties. Doesn't mandate that anything has to happen, but it does provide a vehicle by which, in a framework, that they can come to, some sort of a joint agreement that there should be competition. We started this discussion probably 3 years ago when we had a number of our telephone companies have difficulty getting into the cable business in that time. Well, we should now say video because that's the new term that encompasses everything. They had a difficult time getting into the video business. One of them went over a year before they got a franchise. Another one went over 14 months before they got a franchise. Others were turned down because they said, well, the incumbent provider gave us this much money. We'd like to have this much money up front from you, and or we want these kind of contributions. And, of course, when you have no customers and no revenue just coming in, you can't meet these kind of demands and also be required, which is what the law would be interpreted by the attorneys that are representing the cable companies in these discussions, then you have to build out everywhere at once, too. Even though you have no customers or no revenue, and you also have to do all of the contributions. I mean, so it was an incredible situation for some of the people that were trying to get into the video business, and as it started the discussion three, four years ago. And I want you to understand something that, it's hard to get into the cable business. And I'll come to that at the end of my comments. There are 853 cities in the state of Minnesota, and there are only about 37 that have competitive cable providers. That's less than 4%. Your cities have a competitor. Now, there's some reason for that. I want you to think about that.
When we had the bill last legislative session, or the session before, and the old days when Representative Bailey was talking about Article 4 with the Senate Conference Committee, the year before that, the only reason that was raised that why we shouldn't pass the bill was because an issue that, and I'll say that the cable companies have manufactured, basically trying to throw up a reason not to do anything, is that, well, we don't trust the municipalities. They may go ahead and not require build-outs, and they may not, you know, ask them to provide services everywhere, and therefore that's going to be redlining and cherry-picking, and cities are going to allow this to happen, and that's awful, so you ought not to pass the bill, you ought not to do anything. And that's the kind of logic that we dealt with last legislative session about this particular bill. And the reason not to proceed, in my mind, you know, cable companies trying to create a reason to keep your monopoly. Now, if we want to step back for a minute, the cable companies, and I'll, when we get to the hearing and talk about the bill, I'll have some examples about how cable companies, as a business practice, redline and or cherry pick where they go and where they provide telephone service, because they're not required to build out everywhere and provide services everywhere when they get into the telephone business. And they do cherry pick. Right now, the 2004, the annual report from the FCC, 29% of the cable companies report that their subscribers are being offered telephone service. Well, what about the other 71% of the cable customers who are not being offered telephone service? It sounds like picking and choosing where you offer service. Maybe that's called redlining.
Mr. Knickerbocker, I'll have to have you wrap up fairly soon.
All right.
So I stay fair with whoever the other two testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, I'll skip the part about why competition is good, why it brings down prices, why competition for service is a good thing, and what's happening in other states. We'll make the assumption we get a chance to talk about that when we, you know, have a hearing on
that's part of the work of your bill,
okay, or whenever it's appropriate. One thing I do want to come back to, though, is the fairness issue. I think Minnesota legislators should see the cable franchise reform issue as a matter of fairness, too. I mean, telephone companies didn't have anybody protecting them from the sudden onslaught of competition of voice in the cable from the cable industry. It's easy for cable companies and other people that offer high-speed internet service to get into the voice market, but it's hard for telephone companies to enter the video market. The ease of entry today into voice is primarily due to, you know, the new techniques, as Representative Beard was discussing, most prominently voice over IP. The people are using basically the internet as a new delivery mechanism. Well, with the convergence of all these multiple communication technologies, everyone's expecting a similar scenario in the video market. But that's not happening, and it's not happening very fast, because the change that's required doesn't rely on technological advances, but the change has to rely on government taking down the roadblocks, like outdated cable franchise laws, were written for another time. Now, to do nothing, to sit, you know, in the legislature and have another session go by and don't recognize the change that's happening out there, as the cable companies would want you to do, is really a plea by the cable companies for government help to stave off their competitors. And it should be rejected. Action is required. Competition is good for customers. The market forces are there waiting to work to benefit customers. And Minnesotans deserve more competition in video services.
Thank you. Any brief questions? Otherwise, we really need to get to the next two testifiers. Mike Martin. And then Jim Erickson will be next. Thank you, Mr. Knickerbocker.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the
record. My name is Mike Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Thank you for the opportunity to be back again today on this zoning issue. Representative Bird has described the provisions of 238 that are at play here. I'd like to stress some things relevant to that. It's true, Minnesota law is very clear about franchises being non-exclusive. It's specified in Chapter 238. Every franchise that's been awarded since 1973 is non-exclusive. In the 80s, there were amendments adopted to 238 that spelled out exactly how a competing franchise would be dealt with. And it is in those three areas, as he said, only those three areas. And that was an important consideration at the time, that there may be provisions that would require a city to want to have more stringent or more demanding requirements of a second franchise. That really hasn't happened. However, Minnesota does have competing franchises. It's been done. So I would say that on behalf of the companies that are members of the association, the Minnesota Cable Association, that operate, this doesn't just apply to what we're calling incumbent franchises, and it applies to the competing franchises. They are all over the state. There's a number of them, as Mr. Knickerbocker has mentioned. It's impossible for us to escape the conclusion that this is a request to relax the existing requirements to give one competitor an economic advantage over another competitor. It's whatever you want to call it, a thumb on the scale or whatever, but it's basically unfair. Mr. Knickerbocker says he wants fairness. We would say that those are very simple, straightforward rules of fairness. You have to build the whole community. That is the social obligation that goes with the provision of video service in Minnesota. If you get into the telephone service, you have social obligations. You have to provide 911, you have to support CALEA, you have to contribute to TAP and other programs. There's social obligations on both sides. In video, it's a requirement that you build out the whole community so that this side of the street doesn't have a different kind of service than the homes or businesses on the other side of the street. Second area I'd like to address is this business of monopoly. First of all, cable companies have never served, they serve the entire area, but they've never served, we're not 100% service. We have, one of our competitors is no. Many of the residents in your community, as you know, many people at this table do not subscribe to cable. It doesn't have the same kind of tenants that traditional power monopoly like we're talking about, or telephone monopoly where you're serving 100+% of the homes. That's a consideration you have to remember. Secondly, there's a couple of things about the market itself that you should always remember about cable. Those systems have been entirely financed by private risk capital. There's no subsidy mechanism, there's no universal service, there's no low-income help, high-cost area provision. Any of those things that you see in the telephone business, those don't apply. The second thing is that every dime of revenue that a cable company has, it comes from a subscriber. There's no subsidy. The revenue comes from the customers and through this capital. I think those are very important considerations. On a broader scale, and I'm glad Representative Bird's looking to the future, since the 1996 Cable Act, the cable industry has spent, what, $100 billion across the country, which converts to about $500 million in Minnesota, to develop and advance these systems that are going to bring the very services that we're talking about here. Our technology, our fiber coax systems are the ones that are bringing these services. We're the ones that have literally led the way. Most communities today have high-speed service because cable companies
upgraded their facilities and adopted new technologies that have literally led the way on this. I think those are very important considerations. Now, I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage because I hear that Representative Beard is suggesting new language and change, and we, of course, haven't seen that. So it's hard to respond. We certainly would want
you certainly will have that grant, and everybody. I mostly wanted to just kind of update the committee, give us a flavor of the discussion that the working groups will look at in more detail before they bring back any legislation. And I mean, they'll have to pass it to bring it back too. So, but just rest assured that you'll have language, and you may be a part of language that's created. So,
all right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tucson.
Just a quick question. There's probably more for information to get, but you said $500 million investment over what?
Since the Telecom Act of 1996.
Oh,
yes, over a 10-year period.
And you know, and that's in Minnesota.
In Minnesota.
Do you know how much, like, in terms of return on investment or profit the cable companies have gotten in Minnesota in that same time?
No.
Is that possible to get?
I can ask you.
Okay.
I can see if I can find out. I don't know, but I mean, I'll try.
Okay. I didn't expect you to know that.
Any other questions?
No.
All right. Any more, Mr. Martin? Or
no, I look forward to talking about it.
Okay. Great. Last, we'll, Jim Erickson. Jim, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm
aware of the time.
Pleased, and I know you're about out of time, so I'll be brief. Let me say that I want to associate myself with the remarks of Representative Beard with respect to the recommendation to read the world as flat. Clearly, one of the things that you ran for and is your job as a legislator is to try and improve the quality of life. And I think there's probably no resource book that you could look at that might give you better advice about how to do that job of improving the quality of life of Minnesotans than that book. And I certainly commend it to you, and I recommend him and applaud him for recommending it to you. My name is James Erickson. I'm the chairman, president of an organization called Fiber First Minnesota. Fiber First Minnesota is a nonprofit advocacy and education group aimed at encouraging and educating the deployment of fiber optics to the home. FTTH is the phrase that you may see, or FTTP, meaning the premises. But fiber optics to the home are the deepest deployment of fiber optics, that rural connectivity that Representative Beard had talked about, and that's what my organization is here to do. So we're not here to choose sides exactly between the battle that you will hear, and many times at this podium and in this legislative session, perhaps between what is known as the cable industry and what is known as the telephone industry. They're really becoming very similar. As you know, the convergence of those providers and their products that they provide no longer meets the old definitions that we think of. I recommend another piece of information for you. This is the story in the New York Times in November called Calling Out the Cable Guy, detailing the competitive battle that is now going on between and will continue to develop between the cable industry as such and as defined, and the telephone industry as such and as defined. But the distinctions between those two industries are greatly changing. The point I'd like to make, again, going back to what your job should be in deciding which of those two arguments from those two industries with this particular bill and anything you do in this area is this. Let me just read. I'm going to email to Brian a task force report from the city of Seattle that I'm going to read just 8 sentences from that I think very much call out the issues that you'll have to weigh in the balance as you make decisions with respect to particular legislation vis-a-vis the views of that legislation by any industry. And let me read it. And when I say the word Seattle from this task force report, read Minnesota. In the next half century, the cities, we could say the states, economic, social, cultural, and cultural success will depend in part on its broadband infrastructure. That is what we are talking about here. Seattle, I can say Minnesota, in particular, would benefit from the availability of increased bandwidth because it is a leader in the information economy. We too. Seattle, Minnesota, could gain competitive advantage by becoming an early adopter of broadband. Seattle's economy will grow if broadband gives local businesses advantages that aren't available elsewhere. A majority of Seattle residents are networked information in technology today, and their demand for access to state-of-the-art technology and services will continue to increase. To serve future needs, networks must be available with bandwidth capable to simultaneously deliver voice, video, and data. Fiber optic cable extended to the premises, that is to the home, is the only technology available today with the capacity to meet all of Seattle's, Minnesota's long-term needs. In a nutshell, that's the challenge. Now, there's fiber optics all over this great state and all over this great city. These large pipes that connect us with China and India and make the world small. Actually, the world isn't flat. We all know that. What Mr. Friedman meant to say was the world is very small, and China and India and all its consumers and all its competitive resources are now as close to us as next door because of the fiber optics cable that connects us. And we have these big pipes running all over the world, and they stop about 500 feet or 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet from your front door. And what I suggest and what we suggest at Fiber First is we find ways to encourage, to facilitate the deployment of that fiber optic cable all the way to the home. And just think what we would then do in terms of being able to tap in to the resources of a world that is connected with that kind of connectivity. That's what your test ought to be with respect to anything that comes before you. Is the bill, does it help, does it assist the deployment of that fiber optic cable all the way to the home so that we in Minnesota, just as they in Seattle, can employ those benefits? Mr. Chairman, I know you're ending the day. I'll be delighted to return as part of this discussion to provide information with respect to this. More definitions on the term broadband. Obviously, wireless is a part of this. I'm a wired guy because it is wired. Fiber optic that will give us the capacity we need, but wireless is another component of this broadband definition. It's a fascinating discussion. It is vital to the economic viability and future of the state. What you do here has a lot to do with how you can encourage that both competition in the provision of that broadband pipe and in competition in all the services that come through it. And I thank you for the time, and I look forward to this very interesting and enlightening, I hope, debate.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Any questions? Representative Gunther.
Yeah, Mr. Erickson, can you tell me how many systems need a cable or phone system to provide gigabyte speed? Minnesota, not Seattle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, in Minnesota there are 29 cities or, I guess, locations that have some form of fiber optic to the home. That is, some provider, and there are several kinds, are providing service to the home, all the way from China and India or wherever, to a home through fiber optic. And that fiber optic cable would be capable of gigabit service. They range in examples of providers. The city of Windham, which is, has built a fiber-to-the-home network municipally, to the city of Rosemont, where a company called FTTH Communications has installed in a subdivision that it has built fiber-to-the-home connections. And by the way, we should give great credit to the particularly the small rural telephone industry here, who you're probably very familiar with. I suspect of those 29 communities, perhaps 20 of them are provided their local independent phone ILEC or sometimes a CLEC. Federated Telephone, Paul Bunyan Telephone are now deploying fiber optics
to the home. So those communities are going to have that service. So it's kind of interesting that we probably have more individuals hooked up to that fiber in the rural area than we do in the... So the digital divide, perhaps in that particular case, is the reverse of what you ought to think. But what I think you want to do is, any legislation comes before you, is that legislation going to encourage other deployers, other telephone companies, big or small, other cable companies, their providers already, other independent greenfield developers, other small companies, such as HBC, that just overbuilt the city of the city of Wabasha, competing with Quest and Charter there. They thought it was an economic thing to do, and Wabasha now has two competitors, really three. The old monopoly language, I think, is fading away, because it's really a duopoly now, that the phone companies and the cable companies are competing in getting into their space, so there's growing competition. And now in the city of Wabasha, an individual provider, HPC, has come in and overbuilt Wabasha and is providing service through a fiber optic connection to Wabasha's folks, and now they have that competition. So that's the test you should apply to all legislation. I'm here to continue to answer questions and hope you go forward with the concepts involved that Mr. Baird has talked about, and the world is flat.
Well, Mr. Erickson, thank you for your testimony, and certainly, as the working group, as Mike would call meetings, you're welcome to attend as well.
I might just say one more thing. With me today is an associate of mine who's working on this with me. It's Mr. Wim Boyden, the former state senator, who was the author in 1973 of Chapter 238. So with that historic note, to thank you for your time.
Thank you. Members, as I said, if you have bills that you talk to groups about bringing, try to get them drafted as soon as you can. Letting Brian even know they're coming would be helpful, just so we can kind of schedule the early meetings, because really the early meetings are going to be our only meetings, because within 3 weeks or so we'll have deadlines to start meetings. So we're thinking of that. This is a good starter. If we have anything more, I would predict it will be the last half of February if we hold any more regulated meetings before session. Right now, there's nothing officially scheduled, so we'll keep you posted with that. Thank you to everybody who showed up today and the audience as well, and the meeting is adjourned. 5:46.